You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints. Former Senator Barbara Boxer's son caught in a big-time Indian casino ripoff. Also, Randy Credico joins us to talk about the heightened threat of arrest of Julian Assange based on recently released government documents. And, well, we got a lot more coming up. We're going to have you join us as well. What you all think about free speech. So get ready to give us a call. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilamoli and all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Just a little bit, we'll be joined by Randy Credico to talk about what's happening internationally with Julian Assange. Randy has been deeply engaged there, right in the middle. We did some reporting together on Assange. We interviewed Assange together, and it seems like the U.S. government is ready to make the catch, and Assange is in more jeopardy than ever. So we're going to talk about that and free speech and how you feel about all that, but first, we take it to the north of our own country and talk about a story that originally appeared in the Bohemian up north. It's now in national edition of the consortiumnews.com. And it's a powerful story, and it's a disturbing story. And again, joining us to talk about it is Peter Byrne. His piece in Consortium Now is Judge Finds Breach of Contract and Trust. Welcome to Flashpoints, Peter Byrne.
Thanks, Dennis.
Well, it is really good to have you with us. Can I ask you to begin by just laying this story out? Give us the backdrop and the overview.
Well, part of the headline of the story is former Senator Barbara Boxer's son and California power broker found bilking Indian tribe. That's the very short version. What happened basically is that back in 2000, Senator Barbara Boxer sponsored legislation restoring the national sovereignty of the Federated Indians of the Great Rancheria, a tribe based in Sonoma County near Santa Rosa. And shortly after their status was restored, they were all given permission by the federal government to operate a business, including a casino business. They were approached by Boxer's son, Douglas Boxer, who's a lawyer and a political lobbyist who works with one of the most powerful men in California, a man named Darius Anderson. Anderson has been around for decades. He's funded millions of dollars worth of Democratic Party politicians from Willie Brown to Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, and Jerry Brown. And he's a real estate developer. He's redeveloping Treasure Island, which is one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in the world, with public money in San Francisco Bay. And he's a political consultant. He runs a firm called Platinum Advisors that hooks up corporations with government contracts. On the side, back in 2002, he and Boxer made a deal with the Graydon tribe that they would help them establish a casino. And then, unknown to the tribe at the time, Boxer and Anderson formed a separate company, which they called Kenwood Investments Number 2, which got an option to buy 1,700 acres of protected wetland at in the north of the San Francisco Bay near Highway 37. And they bought the option with the intention of eventually getting the tribe to buy the land. They didn't tell the tribe that they had done this. They didn't tell them about Kenwood Number 2. But as Platinum Advisors, they advised them to buy the land. What happened eventually was that the tribe got on the hook to buy the option for $750,000, which Boxer and Anderson had only paid $100,000 for. And then they had to buy the land to the tune of $4 million, which was a problem because it's impossible to build a casino with parking lots and everything that goes with it on a protected wetland. It caused a big stir at the time, although it wasn't known until recently the involvement that Boxer and Anderson had, what turned out to be a fairly example of fraud. And we can say the F word, fraud, mm-hmm. because about 2017, there was a court arbitration in San Francisco Superior Court overseen by that. And it basically found that Anderson and Boxer had, quote unquote, defrauded the tribe. What happened was that not only were they trying to sell the swamp land to the tribe for an exorbitant amount of money, which they were profiting on, they weren't telling the tribe that they were doing that. They also approached a number of high-profile Las Vegas gambling corporations like Station Casinos and Harrah's and MGM and others, telling them that they were representing the tribe and that the tribe needed somebody to help them set up a casino, to develop it, to loan them money, and then to run the casino on its behalf. They didn't tell the tribe that they were approaching these Las Vegas corporations, however. They sent out a bidding document, and Harrah's actually responded to it with a pretty good deal for the tribe, saying that they would loan it $25 million and give it pre-development costs and a scholarship fund and stuff like that. But what the Harrah's didn't do was agree to the terms that Anderson was trying to extract in his bid solicitation, which was that he wanted about $10 million for his firm, Kenwood Number Investments Number 2. And he basically wanted 10% of the revenue of the casino going forward. Harrah's said, no, we want to talk to the tribe directly, or we need to know that you are legitimately representing them, and we don't want to give you all this money as a middleman. We'll give you a lesser amount. But Anderson and Boxer didn't tell the tribe that Harrah's had made a bid. In fact, the tribe didn't know until 2003 that the RFPs, the bidding solicitations, had actually been put out there at all. By that time, it was getting a little bit late, and there was a brouhaha around the attempt to put the casino on the wetlands. The tribe backed down after Dianne Feinstein said that she would basically take away their sovereignty, and the tribe eventually paid $100 million for some fairly wetland up in Santa Rosa, which they proceeded to build the Graton Resort and Casino on, which is operating to this day. When the casino opened in 2013, Anderson wrote a letter to the tribe on the opening day, in fact, saying that the tribe owed him $43 million, which was his calculation of the percentage of revenue that he believed his contract allowed him to have from its future earnings. Now, at that time, Anderson and Boxer hadn't done any work for the tribe since about 2005, and that work was clearly inadequate, and as the judges later determined, was fraudulently inducing them to do things that didn't not in their own interest, and was a breach of contract, to use the judges' terms. But they asked for $43 million, and the tribe said no, and the tribe sued them in the Superior Court, saying that sovereign immunity precluded Anderson from taking this matter to arbitration, which is what he wanted to do. And the tribe lost because they had signed a contract with Anderson and Boxer that waived their sovereign immunity. So the thing did have to go to arbitration, and it did. It went into a very expensive 2-month-long arbitration trial in the summer of 2017 at a judicial arbitration service in San Francisco. There were very expensive lawyers involved, thousands of pages of depositions and testimony. And at the end, the judges made a ruling that was posted on the court, certified by the San Francisco Superior Court, posted last June. And the ruling said that Anderson and Boxer, through their firm Kenwood Investments Number 2, had defrauded the tribe and breached their contract, and that actually Anderson wasn't entitled to any money. In fact, he owed the tribe's legal fees, which amounted to about $750,000. Anderson didn't have any recourse. He and Boxer apparently agreed that the arbitration agreement would not be appealed, which meant that it stands as the truth to this day. And I happened to run across it because I've been covering a casino for the North Bay Bohemian off and on for years, and I was following the case, and I saw that the arbitration agreement had been filed, and I printed it out and read it, and my mouth fell open. I was astonished. I mean, I'm a fairly cynical investigative reporter type, and I was just amazed at how this person, Darius Anderson, who casts himself as a philanthropist and a liberal a public servant, a man who of integrity, who cares about his community, and including racial minorities, the extent to which he had gone to extort and defraud this Indian tribe who was just trying to get a handle on life, you know. I mean, they've been through a lot the past 500 years. So I expected that probably the mainstream media would pick it up and write about it, but they didn't. And so eventually I published a pretty long explanation of the story in the North Bay Bohemian. The only other newspaper that wrote about it, and this is kind of an interesting corollary, the Press Democrat, which is the local rag up here, wrote a very small little story saying that there had been a dispute between Anderson and the tribe that it had been resolved, but they didn't mention the fraud word or any of the gory details that I just laid out to you, and there are many more. The Press Democrat, I will have to tell our listeners, is owned by guess who, Dennis?
I can't imagine, except maybe the New York Times.
It's owned by Darius Anderson.
Oh.
He bought it about 5 years ago. He bought up all the print media in the North Bay region.
It used to be owned by it used to be a New York Times paper, right?
Yeah, they sold it about 10 years ago to Halifax Media, and then Halifax sold it to Darius.
Who
set up an LLC with the former publisher of the Chronicle, Doug Bosco, a former congressperson who has had some interesting ethical issues along the way, and several other characters. So they actually bought not only the Press Democrat, which is kind of used as their local media organization to promote their interests. Darius owns a bunch of restaurants and hotel type things. Doug Bosco owns a bunch of, or lobbies for a bunch of railroad and timber interests. The Press Democrat promotes all of their interests regularly and shamelessly. But they also bought up like the Petaluma Argus Courier, the Sonoma Index Tribune.
So in other words, it's interesting. We have to move on. But the amazing thing here is what the bottom line of what you're saying is they controlled the media, and thus this story, which is a huge freaking story about the son of the former Senator Barbara Boxer, engaged in some very ugly situations using the liberal cause as a cover. There's more to come on this, but we thank you, Peter Byrne, for bringing it to our attention and starting it there in the local-based papers where some of the great stories are being written now. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dennis.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Very short musical break. And then I know we're going to join Randy Credico, and we're going to talk about Julian Assange. I spend most of the rest of the show doing that. So stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We take it to New York City, where we are joined by Randy Credico. Randy, among other things pertaining to what we're going to talk about, which is Julian Assange, Randy was on the cutting edge, in the forefront of recognizing the importance of a publisher, an independent publisher like Julian Assange, the work that Assange was doing, the significant contributions he made to the big press and to the alternative press. And Randy Credico went to wanted to cover this.
Hello.
excuse me. And we, again, we have seen recent revelations in the last 24 hours that confirm the fact that the U.S. government wants to put Julian Assange in jail, wants to try him, and some folks want to kill him. Randy, there's no surprise here, but it is still shocking to see this pop up in sort of a document about something else.
Right. It really was a surprise. You know, I've been tied up all day today with other stuff relating to the Mueller probe. But this thing came up this morning about this kind of a glitch that there was a cut and paste piece of an indictment on something that was made public. Now, I can't get into the fine points of it all, but certainly it's very shocking and revealing that there is an outstanding indictment against Julian Assange. And I'm not surprised that this is going on under a president that is one of the most anti-press, anti-free press presidents in the history of the United States, if not the worst, this guy. So, you know, those who think that Trump is somehow a friend of WikiLeaks or is a friend of the free press or Julian Assange or have pipe dreams. And those out there who are pretending to be supporters of Assange but are supporters of Trump certainly have been exposed today.
And of course, there's no question that Julian Assange, his work, they did fight for him to get a little more wiggle room to be able to get a couple of visits, to be able to have a little more room to act, but not to do his work.
Stop there. You say the little bit of wiggle room. To go in there, it's like, you know, someone of color trying to get into Studio 54 back in the 70s in New York. You know, you needed 500 IDs, DNA samples, and all of that to get in. So to get in there right now, you have to give them all sorts of information. You basically have to become an informant to get in. If you're going to go in and send Julian Assange, you have to become a unpaid informant for the government. That's what they've done. They've made his life so uncomfortable, the new president of – you may as well – I'm going to call him Batista right now. I'm going to start calling this guy Batista. I'm going to call him Somoza. And I'm talking about – let's not be nice with Mr. Moreno. He is a banana republic president that has sucked up to the IMF. He sucked up to Mike Pence. He sucked up to right-wing congressmen like this guy Engel from New York, who, you know, they want to stop, they want to gag, they want to destroy a guy who is a messenger. You know, they call messenger a song, a messenger a truth. That's him. That's what they're trying to do is, like, they're worried about one guy. You've got a million – this reminds me of Spartacus going against the Roman Empire. One guy. Or William Wallace going against Longshanks. Yeah, one guy. They all want to destroy him. What are they afraid of? What is it that he has? What kind of crime has he committed? This is one of the most outrageous travesties, just the thought of it, in the history of the human race.
And the other side of that, Randy, of course, the sickening response of the corporate press. Now, I was listening to this coverage of this story, this revelation about this Assange arrest, U.S. officials wanting to arrest him on NPR. And it was the NPR reporter. I'm blanking on her name now. And she's doing things like she refers. This coverage here in the Bay Area came over KQED, KALW. She refers to the charges being brought by the Swedish government?
Yes.
The charges that are being brought. Charged. She refers to those as current charges. Everybody who listens to NPR, seriously, you want to do some fact-checking? How could their reporter refer to charges that were never brought?
There were never charges. There were not even basic. There were allegations that were kept alive on fumes from the Crown Prosecutor Services out of London because it's a political case.
And they were dropped.
There was never any charges filed. Do you understand? This was an investigation that they wanted to close in 2011.
But they closed the investigation as well.
No, they kept it alive at the behest of the British Crown Prosecutor Services, at the behest of the whoever rules Britain. We know it's not the Queen. The Queen's not involved in this stuff. But whoever runs it, BAE, BP, all of these other corporations that run it, they run Tony Blair and Jack Straw, these two war criminals that are still – I mean, do you know Jack Straw and Tony Blair, responsible for a million deaths or half a million deaths in Iraq, are still walking the streets of London with impunity? I mean, you know, they should be charged. They're the ones that they should be going after. Those two guys are responsible for genocide, along with President Bush. They're responsible for genocide, and they got a guy who skipped bail, and that would be obviated by the fact that there are no charges, so the bail conditions should just disappear. But that's, they're spending all of this money, 17 million pounds a year, to keep an eye on a guy. This means that he is powerful. This means this guy has a lot to say, and those who are charging him have a lot to hide, and that's what they're doing. They have a lot to hide, and they're afraid of him exposing. That's how powerful he is, and these charges in the U.S. under this president who once said, WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks. He's the guy going after them. After him and WikiLeaks. And it's not just WikiLeaks that, I mean, Julian Assange, whose life is in danger and freedom. It's everyone that works at WikiLeaks or is connected to WikiLeaks. Their freedom and their well-being is in jeopardy because of the continuous, unrelenting onslaught on the whole concept of what Julian Assange represents, which is a free press, total sunshine, sunlight on government. That's what we want. He represents the First Amendment in flying colors. That's what he represents. He's the person that the founding fathers of the United States envisioned when they wrote the First Amendment.
Randy Credico talking to us from New York City. His he sort of transformed his radio show into a live act, live on the flood. The new name, and I know you're going to continue doing this work. What is the show called?
It was Randy Credico Live on the Fly, but it was Julian Assange Countdown to Freedom. We did 22 episodes. I did 10 in New York. One that you came in when we did his mother. And then we did 11 more together, maybe 12 more together. So it's really a collaborative process that you and I put together here. Same way you and the late, great Robert Knight put together with Undercurrents back in the 80s. So, you know.
So let me, now I want to, Randy, I want to ask you, there's so many things you know about this, and I want to sort of talk to you a little bit. You were at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, a dinner that included people, many of which Jews depended upon, you know, helped to sell papers or network time based on the revelations from Julian Assange, right?
Right. The Washington Post, CNN, New York Times. CNN got the big
one. They all used WikiLeaks. They all reported.
All of them used.
Okay, and you, what happened? What happened when you tried to stand up at that White House Correspondents' Dinner, where all those folks who learned and grew and published stories on based on Julian Assange revelations, WikiLeaks? How, what was their response?
I was basically gagged, drawn, and quartered out of there by four orderlies that looked like they were from Bellevue, and put in a metaphorical straitjacket and dragged out of there like Randall P. McMurphy in...
What did you say that made them so angry?
I said, why are we not celebrating Julian Assange today? He's the greatest journalist. What he has done is the greatest journalist. Whatever I said, it was just, you know...
You just stood up on a chair.
I stood on a chair, and then I got, I mean, and everybody was there. I mean, it's a room of like 2,500. It was just like they were at a bullfight or something, cheering on CNN. And, you know, look, there are some people. I sat at the CNN table for a few minutes, and I said, wait a second, man. All these people are eating steak and lobster, and they're drinking red wine and champagne, and Julian Assange is in a room, a room and a half. It's a toll booth and a half, basically. It's hot, and he suffered for 6.5 years. He's the finest He's the avatar of journalism. He represents journalism at its very best. And he is relegated, not relegated, but he's suffering in this little space without any kind of movement, any sunlight, any fresh air. And everybody here is basically sucking up the power. And it's one of these things where it's, you know, they're sucking
up. And what did all these big-time journalists say or do?
They didn't even take a picture of me. They dragged me out of there.
No coverage.
There was nothing, not even a photo. I think
we covered it.
Got rid of me. They were glad you and Max Blumenthal covered me and some others. My good friend from Anonymous covered it, Scandinavia. But, you know, not too many people covered it. I think WikiLeaks did something. But it wasn't maybe Sputnik, whatever. You know, they did. But it was not really well received. It wasn't right. Really well covered.
Yeah.
But that's what I did there. I said I could not live with myself watching this opulence. You know, people, it was like being in Russia in 1880, and you had the Moscow press there with Alexander II, and everyone is like, you know, doing stuff that is favorable to the Tsar. That's what it felt like that day. And so I had to. I couldn't, you know, the thing is that I could have gone to the parties at MSNBC afterwards. I could have gone to the parties at CNN. I was invited to all of them. But you know what? I probably would have committed suicide if I had done that afterwards for not seizing that moment. You see, you got moments like that that you can speak out, and you can never, you can't reverse that. If I had not said anything, do you know today I'd be saying to myself, why didn't I say something? Why didn't I do something? Everybody's got to do what they can to help out here. Whatever you can do from whatever angle to really help out Mr. Assange, because he's someone that we need now more than ever. Can you imagine what he would have done to the Kavanaugh hearings, to the Khashoggi murder, to what's going on with this caravan? Can you imagine if he was able to operate right now? They said, well, you can do something, but it can't be political. What do they want him to do, like do sports stories? Like cover cricket in New Zealand? I mean, what to the frick do they want him to do? But they're making his life so uncomfortable right now. This is his way, President Moreno, President Batista, President Somoza, whatever you want to call this guy. He's no Correa. He's sold out, and I understand everyone's got a price. He got his price, and he's sucking up to Trump. Imagine this guy is sucking up to Trump. President Moreno is sucking up to Trump.
All right. That's the voice of Randy Credico. Randy was the originator of a series, Alive on the Fly. It was the Countdown to Freedom. It was all about Julian Assange, the history and the struggle to free him. We had an opportunity on Flashpoints to participate in some of the later segments.
You were a big part of it. You know, you carried it on. You know, during the Stefania Morici case with Estelle DeHorn. So, Dennis, you were as big a player in this. This is a collaborative effort, and you really enhance the overall production of this. And I really appreciate the fact that you picked up when I was unceremoniously let go at WBAI. You picked up the mantle and you kept it going for Julian Assange.
Well, it was an absolute honor, and it was crucial. It was at the heart of the matter of what we do, what we've been doing here at Flashpoints for 30 years, and what we do if we call ourselves a real radical alternative to the corporate press. This is, you know, and again, there's so much about this. You know, so goes, so, if they get Julian Assange, we're all, they can put us all in jail. And even the freaking lawyers for the New York Times have admitted that the Times can be prosecuted in the same framework as it is being laid out against Julian Assange. Of course,
you know what, Dennis? Can I just jump in here for a minute? Do you know that guy, Jim Acosta, has never been to a war zone? Jim Acosta has never been in a situation like Julian Assange. Jim Acosta, who everyone is like, oh, my God, the poor guy has been taken away. The WikiLeaks doesn't even have a hard card, and neither does KPF. A, have a hard card to get in there into the White House correspondence room. All right, there are a lot of news organizations that don't have a hard card. He has one, and I'm sorry that he was kicked out of there, and I think the president is anti-press and all of that, and I think they should give him back his card. He has never experienced the kind of travails and tribulations that Julian Assange has undergone to protect the First Amendment and the whole notion of a free press. He's at the very front line. He is in the foxhole. You know, Jim Acosta is way back at the dance hall doing military police duty. Julian Assange is on the front line in the foxhole facing mustard gas, as it were.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Randy Credico. In a few minutes, Randy, I'd like to take some phone calls, but I also want to remind, and that number, by the way, if you want to check in with us, is and really we're interested in, we're talking about, at the bottom line here is free speech, celebrating, making love to the First Amendment. That's exactly what this is all about, and it's about freedom of speech, which we believe and share with Randy, who has pushed that envelope in so many different ways in terms of public speech, that he is a hero of mine and has used the power of free speech to take on things like three strikes and stop and frisk effectively. So, you know, there's a lot we can say about Randy, but Randy, you in doing your work with Julian Assange and a relationship that you had evolved with Roger Stone that led to the undermining of the Rockefeller laws, the lightening, the release of folks. Roger Stone has sort of done this sort of dance to bottom line, ingratiate himself with the Trumps and do the importance thing, overstating his position and trying to sort of, turn a profit or whatever from the notoriety, which has been, you know, what he does.
That's what he does. He's a businessman, but he's of absolutely no use to Julian Assange. How he insinuated himself into this has
Talk about that, please.
He's detracted, and as have a lot of these other alt-right people who pretend to be Assange supporters. They are not, and please, these are false prophets that have insinuated themselves into the movement to free Julian Assange. If Julian Assange had done anything negative on the Trump campaign, I mean, you really didn't have to do that because there was so much stuff that was negative on him. There was no way he was supposed to win because there was nothing anything that was good on him. He was the worst candidate of all time. But if he had lost, believe me, all these people, these Johnny Come Latelys who've shown up, these alt-right figures, Jack Posobiec, Mike Cernovich, Cassandra Fairbanks, and people of that ilk, a woman by the name of Angel Fox, all these nutcases who are racist and support the repression of the caravan coming up, they are not doing Julian Assange any good whatsoever. They are hurting his cause, and they should stay away, and they should not be allowed in. Some of these alt-right people, they don't like Assange. If it was between Assange and Trump, they would throw Assange under the bus in a minute. Their loyalty is to Trump, not to Assange. Whereas people that I know, MEB, Emmy Putin, Anonymous Scandinavia, and all these other people that I know who are hardcore people.
John Pilger.
Political thoughts. Mm. John Pilger, Craig Murray, all these progressives out there, they're the ones that we should be listening to because they're the ones who are the whistleblowers. They're the ones that are there for truth. They're the ones that we should be following. They're at the front lines, and it's not the Trump, the Trump is going after. I mean, he'd shut you down in a minute, okay?
Right. I want to hold on a second. I want to give out the number. It's 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. You have testified before the Mueller grand jury how many times?
Not not the grand jury. One time in front of the grand jury, but I'll be going back in front of them because.
So you met with the committee several times. You met with the.
I came out with the prosecutors, and in other words, their crew, because of these the whole thing with the Stone lying about me, how he had back. Whatever he did, he backslapped. It gave a backhand to WikiLeaks and to Julian Assange. His involvement here has done nothing but to hurt the cause of Julian Assange because, you know, people look at Julian Assange and, geez, associated with Roger Stone, the most filthy human being, the most obnoxious human being.
And that was a lie. That was a big lie created by Stone.
Nothing could do with him. Nothing could do with him. WikiLeaks has said many times that Stone, we have no contact.
And it would be so out of character if people understood how WikiLeaks operates and the nature of the structure, they would understand what a farce, what a foolish assumption that Roger Stone could somehow, or you, for that matter, could be the conduit.
You wouldn't trust me with his laundry, okay?
But what did they want from you? What exactly did?
Well, they know that Stone has been lying about this, right? They want to know what this is all about. The fact is that Stone had nothing to do with any of this, and so they're doing an investigation. By the way, the times that I've met with them, they're not even interested in Assange. It's like it's a peripheral part. I think the House and the Senate and their grandstand, they're more interested in getting information about Assange. You know, so that's why I took the Fifth with them. And in the Mueller probe, I think they're just trying to get to wherever they're trying to get to at this point. And they know. Believe me, you go in there, they know more than you. It's like going to watching a Columbo episode. Columbo knows who the killer is before the killer knows who he is, all right? So that's what – they have everything. So Stone has been lying. The thing is, like, what pisses me off about Stone is that he has associated this thus infecting Assange with being associated with Trump and Bannon and all of these guys. Stone had absolutely no contact with them. They'd never wanted to have contact. They dressed them down on it several times. They distanced themselves. Stop saying that we're connected to you because we're not. And so, he had to keep saying it.
Okay.
And
let's bring
him.
Sorry, Randy, you're listening to Flashpoints. Let's bring in Caroline. Carolyn, join us on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. You're on with Randy Credico.
Hello, Dennis. This is Carolyn. Thank you so much. I would like you to say a few more words about this guy, Elliot Engels, representative. He is evidently the ranking member in a previous incarnation of the House, the ranking member of the House Foreign Relations Committee, and there's some thought that he might be actually put as chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee. Can I ask you to put some focus on that and stop this guy because he's a real fascist. He is against the Iran nuclear deal. He supported the attack on Iraq. And if you go to Roots Action, you can see all the things that...
All right. Thank you.
Let me just go ahead. And that's a good point about Elliot Engel. He's the one that sent a letter to Moreno, Lenin Moreno, saying that... Of Ecuador, saying, we're going to hold back drug and interdiction aid, as if that would be a problem. Please hold it back. We're going to hold back drug interdiction aid to an IMF aid and all of these other U.S. Programs, military and all of that, to your country unless you expel Julian Assange. This guy was a Democrat from the Bronx. Now, he's from the Bronx in a gerrymandered district. He's never had an opponent, Elliot Engel. He's the AIPAC congressman. He's Chuck Schumer on a congressional level. Not, you know, he's in the House and not in the Senate. But he's one of these guys, complete military industrial complex whore, complete Israeli anti-Palestinian representative. The thing is, he represents part of the Bronx, and that doesn't represent them. See, Ocasio, who got rid of Crowley movie was the Queen's version of Engel. So, but Engel did not get a primary. He will, even if I have to do it in 2 years and get rid of this guy. He is a complete stooge. He's the reason why people hate the Democratic Party, is Elliot Engel. He is totally a, like I said, he is a bad guy. He's anti-free press, and he tried to blackmail. What he did is a crime, trying to blackmail and extort Moreno into expelling Julian Assange out of a legally asylum position in the Ecuadorian embassy. That's illegal. He's telling him to violate the Constitution of Ecuador. Can you imagine this kind of arrogance? If someone from Ecuador told him that they should expel someone here back to Ecuador or to any place else, can you imagine that?
All right, let's keep going here. The number is 1-800.
Thank you for that call, by the way. Thank you. That's a very important
call. Yeah, and with one of our seasoned activists of the Bay Area. The number is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. Julian Assange, free speech. What's your thought on this? We're joined by Mac in Berkeley, California. Mac, join us.
Hey, Mac.
Hey, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed your stuff over the years, man. Hey, I just wanted to bring up that whole thing with Assange. Admitting that he got the Hillary emails, you know, from an insider and not the Russians. It seems like some people, like the Democrats, need the Russians because they really don't want to admit to people how much they suck. So, you know, it's just a cover story. And the evidence has been pointing to, that they were leaked and not hacked by Russians. Several people have proved it by data and all that stuff, but they just don't seem to want to talk about it. Okay, thank you.
Randy.
All right. Well, first of all, wherever he got it, he got it. And he, since he's an honest individual that I believe 100%, I've been around him and had the great pleasure of being in his company three times, very instructional and educational. I must tell you, enlightening, that the that wherever that came, wherever the DNC, it wasn't a hack, it was a leak. I mean, please, it definitely was not like somebody hacked into the DNC. And everybody knows the history there with CrowdStrike, that they wouldn't let the FBI look at it and everything. There was some disgruntled, I don't know who did it, but it definitely was not from a Russian. It didn't take, and then as far as Podesta goes, it could have been me, because Podesta fell for one of those things where, you know, those night, if you like answer this survey, you'll get $1 billion from the Nigerian wealthy guy. That's what he did. He fell for that. And so it could have been a 3-year-old kid who got his Gmail account. Anyone could have gotten that. That didn't take a Russian hacker. That wouldn't take any hacker. It would take a 3-year-old kid. The guy fell for one of these tricks. You go in, please tell us what your new email address is or whatever, and what you want your password to be. They fell for anybody. And I know people have done it, usually elderly people, but it's just a fat cat consultant who's lazy, like Podesta, that fell for one of those fishing expeditions there. And so he was exposed. So we don't know where it came from. When Assange says it didn't come from a Russian actor, you have to believe that. And let's go back to, what was it that he exposed? He exposed corruption in the Democratic Party, in the Democratic process.
Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody ever wants to talk about that.
Let's talk about what Debbie Wasserman Schultz did and what the Democratic National Committee did, how they denied Bernie. This was a suppression of democracy. This is the real interference in our democracy. It wasn't what Julian Assange did. It's what the Democratic Party did. They interfered in our democracy here. And I'm a Democrat. I'm a rep. You know, I hate to admit it, but I'm a registered Democrat. But they, and I supported Sanders. I was violated that day, as was every Democratic voter, when they rigged the system. So that's what it's all about. Assange exposed that. And now you want to kill the messenger. These people that are Democrats and say,
that actually happened? Wait a second. We're into democracy. We're into small d democracy. Let's fix this. That's what they should have done, is fix it so it doesn't happen again. Let the best person win instead of the most corrupt person win.
All right. Listen, we're running out of time. Just a couple of minutes left. Final thoughts, Randy, in terms of, you know, thinking about Julian Assange, defending Julian Assange in the most moral and, you know, consistent way. Your thoughts?
Look, there's a lot of ways to do it. You know, there are people that have online vigils. There are people that have on the street vigils. You know, I'm the on the street person. There's every day in London, or 3 or 4 days a week, you have a hardcore group with this guy Karen, O'Reilly and Emmy Butin and all these others. If you're in London, you should go there as much as you can and be out in front of the embassy. I think that's the most critical, is to be on the streets. Being on the streets out there, because you know, all my work with the Rockefeller drug law reform movement was, I was always on the street. I like being on the streets. And I think that people, if you're across the pond, check into, get out there over there at Knightbridge by Harrods and form a line out there for him. Let him know that there are people outside that embassy, live people out there willing to go to jail for civil disobedience or for just passive disobedience, just being out there, and let the world see it. Let there be a big cloud and crowd of humanity outside that embassy over there across from Harrods. Go out there. I think that's a great way to get involved. I've always say the human factor inside organizing demonstrations on the street, vigils, passive vigils are the answer right now.
Randy Credico, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Randy.
And thank you to you, Dennis, for keeping this this issue alive on the Pacifica Network. Nobody does it better. Thank you.
Thank you. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to end with what is a non-concession speech from Stacey Abrams in Georgia. She is sort of suggesting that the election part of the election is over, but she's not conceding. Very beautiful comments just before we went to air, so we thought we'd go out with these. Listen to this.
Hello. On September 18th, thousands of Georgians began casting absentee ballots, determined to lift their voices in the democratic process of electing our leaders for the next 2 years, the next 4 years. A few weeks later, more than 2 million Georgians declared their choices, heading to polling places for early votes. And then on November 6th, more than 1 million folks arrived in precincts around our beloved state, anxious and excited to express their patriotism through the fundamental act of voting. For these millions of Georgians, the act may have proven tedious and hard, but they had no doubts their votes would be counted. Certainly, there would be long lines and delays. Absolutely, a tired volunteer would mistype a name. And nature would not be ignored through rain or tornado warnings or chilly weather. We all understand the challenges and the complications. However, this year, more than 200 years into Georgia's democratic experiment, the state failed its voters. You see, despite a record-high population in Georgia, more than 1 million citizens found their names stripped from the rolls by the Secretary of State, including a 92-year-old civil rights activist who had cast her ballot in the same neighborhood since 1968. Tens of thousands hung in limbo, rejected due to human error and a system of suppression that had already proven its bias. The remedy, they were told, was simply to show up. Only they, like thousands of others, found polling places shut down, understaffed, ill-equipped, or simply unable to serve its basic function for lack of a power cord. Students drove hours to hometowns to cast votes because mismanagement prevented absentee ballots from arriving on time. Parents stood in the fitful rain in four-hour lines, watching as less fortunate voters had to abandon democracy in favor of keeping their jobs and collecting a paycheck. Eligible voters were refused ballots because poll workers didn't think they had enough paper to go around. Ballots were rejected by the handwriting police. Citizens tried to exercise their constitutional rights and were still denied the ability to elect their leaders. Under the watch of the now former Secretary of State, democracy failed Georgia. Georgians of every political party, every race, every region, again. You see, the incompetence and mismanagement we witnessed in this election had been on display months before in the Republican state legislative primary of Dan Gasaway. Counties under the direction of the Secretary of State issued flawed ballots, and not for the first time, and not just in that district. But this time, the mistakes clearly altered the outcome. Representative Gasaway, a Republican in a heavily Republican district, had to go to court to force a fair fight. And therefore, on December 4th, tucked between the runoffs for Secretary of State and the Public Service Commission, for one community, there will be justice in the process. Win or lose, the people in his district will finally have a say. Many of the same Republicans cheered on Representative Gasaway when he filed his lawsuit. But the same ones have grumbled about the time we have taken to gain a remedy for fellow Georgians who faced a dizzying array of bad action, misinformation, and gut-wrenching hardship. But we are a mighty nation because embedded in our national experiment is the chance to fix what is broken, to call out what has faltered, to demand fairness wherever it can be found. Which is why on election night, I declare that our fight to count every vote is not about me. It is about us. It is about the democracy that we share and our responsibility to preserve our way of life. Our democracy. Because voting is not a right for some. It is a right for all. And it is not a privilege. I stand here today as witness to that truth. This election is about all of us, as is the resolution of this moment. I acknowledge that former Secretary of State Brian Kemp will be certified as the victor in the 2018 gubernatorial election. But to watch an elected official who claims to represent the people in this state baldly pin his hopes for election on the suppression of the people's democratic right to vote has been truly appalling. So let's be clear. This is not a speech of concession. Because concession means to acknowledge an action is right, true, or proper. As a woman of conscience and faith, I cannot concede that. But my assessment is the law currently allows no further viable remedy. Now, I could certainly bring a new case to keep this one contest alive, but I don't want to hold public office if I need to scheme my way into the post. Because the title of governor isn't nearly as important as our shared title, voters. And that is why we fight on, and why I want to say thank you. Thank you to those of you who organized your communities and shattered records. More than 1.9 million voters who stood up in this midterm for protecting our public schools, for continuing criminal justice reform, for Medicaid expansion, and for real economic mobility for all of our counties. We won state house races and Senate races, a new seat in Congress, and we put America on notice that change is not coming to Georgia. It has arrived, and you made it so. But those who fear change pushed back. And so we waited for the whole truth of this election, good and evil. We waited for it to come forth. So thank you to those of you who shared your stories, for the tens of thousands of calls into our voter protection line. Thank you for volunteering your hours after the polls closed and for the last 10 days, for driving to all 159 counties and hearing the concerns of Georgia citizens through tears and frustration and disappointment. Because you see, Georgia still has a decision to make about who we will be in the next election and the one after that and the one after that. So we have used this election and its aftermath to diagnose what has been broken in our process. Make no mistake, the former Secretary of State was deliberate and intentional in his actions. I know that 8 years of systemic disenfranchisement, disinvestment, and incompetence had its desired effect on the electoral process in Georgia. I also know that we live in a nation where four federal judges were necessary to force the counting of the ballots cast in the face of Brian Kemp's opposition to and disregard for their lawful consideration. I know that millions of Georgians, of Americans, of goodwill and various partisan beliefs, they are enraged by these truths. Now, in response, you may seek to vent your anger, or worse, to turn away from politics because it can be as rotten and rigged as you've always believed. But I implore each of you not to give in to that anger or apathy, but instead turn to action. Because the antidote to injustice is progress. The cure to this malpractice is a fight for fairness in every election held, in every law passed, in every decision made. Pundits and hyperpartisans will hear my words as a rejection of the normal order. You see, I'm supposed to say nice things and accept my fate. They will complain that I should not use this moment to recap what was done wrong or to demand a remedy. You see, as a leader, I should be stoic in my outrage and silent in my rebuke. But stoicism is a luxury, and silence is a weapon for those who would quiet the voices of the people. And I will not concede because the erosion of our democracy is not right. Regardless of party, we want what is best for our children, for our families, for our neighborhoods. We may not share the same faith, but we are knitted together by our belief and our potential for more. I will work in these coming weeks to elect John Barrow as our next Secretary of State because he is a man of principle and goodwill who will administer his responsibilities for the people and not his party. I will work to elect Lindy Miller as our next Public Service Commissioner, where she will speak for those who have been ignored for too long. And I will pray for the success of Brian Kemp, that he will indeed be a leader for all Georgians, that he will pledge to fight for the rights of those who disagree with him, and that he will keep his promises, that he will refuse the call of those who see how close this election really was. Because we know that some are going to propose to make voting even harder. They see voter engagement in communities of color, and they cry fraud, or they lie about the cost of democracy to justify closing more polling places. I pray he will reject this vicious and tired response in favor of preserving what has left and what is left of our state's reputation for equality and civil rights. But I will not leave it to prayers alone. As I have for more than 25 years, I will stand with my fellow Georgians in pursuit of fairness. You see, I did so as a college student, speaking in the shadow of Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. at the 30th anniversary of the March on Washington. I did so as Democratic leader of the House of Representatives and as the Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia. And now I will do so as a private citizen, ready to continue to defend those whose choices were denied full expression. Today, I announce the launch of Fair Fight Georgia, an operation that will pursue accountability in Georgia's elections and integrity in the process of maintaining our voting rolls. In the coming days, we will be filing a major federal lawsuit against the state of Georgia for the gross mismanagement of this election and to protect future elections from unconstitutional actions. We will channel the work of the past several weeks into a strong legal demand for reform of our election systems in Georgia. And I will not waver in my commitment, a lived commitment, to work across party lines and across divisions to find a common purpose in protecting our democracy. Because we deserve a state that elects Democrats and Republicans and independents. We deserve a state that elects leaders who will not tolerate the erosion of our values. Fair Fight Georgia. Because these votes are our voices. And we are entitled to our choices, each of us. And we have always been, Georgia, at the forefront of speaking truth to whatever power may lay claim to leadership, if only for a moment. And we will win because we are Georgia. And I promise you, we will get it done. Thank you.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Chris Hedges gives a fiery speech on resisting fascism. Not preventing fascism, it has already taken over. But, says Hedges, resistance is not only possible, it's necessary. And sometimes it works. I hope you'll stay tuned. Eleven years ago, I began producing this weekly radio program. One of my plans was to broadcast some really fine progressive speakers who were ignored by corporate-controlled radio. Speakers such as Noam Chomsky, Michael Parenti, Gore Vidal, Howard Zinn, George Carlin, and a few others. Alas, time and old age soon began taking their toll. At age 90, give or take a couple of weeks, Noam Chomsky is still as brilliant and as active as ever. But Michael Parenti is less active than before. And Gore Vidal died. Howard Zinn died. George Carlin died. Molly Ivins died. Joe Bagent died. Well, you get the picture. When New World Notes began, Chris Hedges wasn't even on my radar. But over the past decade, Chris Hedges has become perhaps the most active, the most vocal, the most hard-hitting of the radical critics of the status quo. Okay, he's running neck and neck with Chomsky. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a professor at Princeton University, a weekly columnist for Truthdig, and the author of 11 books. He was in fine form on May 26, 2017, in Portland, Oregon. Here he spoke, for more than an hour, at an event titled Stop Fascism in the United States 2017. We will hear most of Hedges' powerful speech this week and next. Life is short and the speech is long, so let's get to it. Chris Hedges begins with a political assassination carried out by the deep state about 1900 years ago.
The decision by the deep state in ancient Rome. Like the United States in 2017, dominated by a bloated military and corrupt oligarchy. To strangle the Emperor Commodus in his bath in the year 192 did not halt the growing chaos and precipitous decline of the Roman Empire. Commodus, like a number of other late Roman empires and like Donald Trump, was incompetent and consumed by his own vanity. He commissioned innumerable statues of himself as Hercules and had little interest in governance. He used his position as head of state to make himself the star of his own ongoing public show. He fought victoriously as a gladiator in the arena in fixed bouts. Power for Commodus, as it is for Trump, was primarily about catering to his bottomless narcissism, hedonism, and lust for wealth. He sold public offices so the ancient equivalents of Betsy DeVos and Steve Mnuchin could orchestrate a vast kleptocracy. Commodus was replaced by the reformer Pertinax, the Bernie Sanders of his day, who attempted to curb the unchecked power of the Praetorian Guards the ancient version of the military-industrial complex. This effort saw the Praetorian Guards assassinate Pertinax after 3 months in office. The guards then auctioned off the office of emperor to the highest bidder. The next emperor, Didius Julianus, lasted 66 days. There would be five emperors in 193 AD, the year after the assassination of Commodus. Trump and our decaying empire have ominous historical precedents. If the deep state replaces Trump, whose ineptitude and imbecility are embarrassing to the empire, that action will not restore our democracy any more than replacing Commodus restored the Republic to Rome. The choice is between inept fascists like Trump and competent fascists like Pence. Our republic is dead. The idiots, seeing in the decay the chance for personal advancement and profit, take over in the final days of crumbling civilizations. Idiot generals wage endless, unwinnable wars that bankrupt the nation. Idiot economists call for reducing taxes for the rich and cutting social service programs for the poor and project economic growth on the basis of myth. Idiot industrialists poison the water, the soil, and the air, slash jobs, and depress wages. Idiot bankers gamble on self-created financial bubbles and impose crippling debt peonage on the citizens. Idiot journalists and public intellectuals pretend despotism is democracy. Idiot intelligence operatives orchestrate the overthrowing of foreign governments to create lawless enclaves that give rise to enraged fanatics. And idiot professors, experts, and specialists busy themselves with unintelligible jargon and arcane theory that buttress the policies of the rulers. Idiot entertainers and producers create lurid spectacles of sex, gore, and fantasy. There is a familiar checklist for extinction. We are ticking off every item on it. The idiots know only one word, more. They are unencumbered by common sense. They hoard wealth and resources until workers cannot make a living and the infrastructure collapses. They live in privileged compounds where they eat chocolate cake and order missile strikes. They see the state as a projection of their own vanity. The Roman, Mayan, French, Habsburg, Ottoman, Romanov, Wilhelmine, Pahlavi, and Soviet dynasties crumbled because the whims and obsessions of ruling idiots were law. Trump is the face of our collective idiocy. He is what lies behind the mask of our professed civility and rationality, a sputtering, narcissistic, bloodthirsty megalomaniac. This face in the past was hidden, at least to most white Americans. But with the destruction of democratic institutions and the disempowerment of the citizen, the oligarchs and the kleptocrats have become brazen. They no longer need to pretend. They steal and lie openly. They wield armies and fleets against the wretched of the earth, blithely ignore the looming catastrophe caused by global warming and cannibalize the nation, while at night, like some monster from the Grand Guignol, the idiot-in-chief, overseeing our self-immolation, sits slack-jawed in front of a television set before opening his beautiful Twitter account. Forget the firing of James Comey. Forget the paralysis in Congress. Forget the inanity of a press that covers our descent into tyranny as if it were a sports contest between corporate Republicans and corporate Democrats or a reality show starring our maniacal president. Forget the noise. The crisis we face is not embodied in the public images of the politicians that run our dysfunctional government. The crisis we face is the result of a four-decade-long, slow-motion corporate coup d'etat that has left corporations and the war machine omnipotent, turned our electoral system into legalized bribery, and elevated public figures who master the arts of entertainment and artifice. Trump is the symptom. He is not the disease. Our descent into despotism began with the pardoning of Richard Nixon, all of whose impeachable crimes are now legal. And the extrajudicial assault, including targeted assassinations and imprisonment, carried out on dissidents and radicals, especially black radicals. This assault, done in the name of law and order, put the organs of internal security, from the FBI to Homeland Security, beyond the reach of the law. It began with the creation of corporate-funded foundations and organizations that took control of the press, the courts, the universities, scientific research, and the two major political parties. It began with empowering militarized police to kill unarmed citizens and the spread of a horrendous system of mass incarceration and the death penalty. It began with the stripping away of our most basic constitutional rights, privacy, due process, habeas corpus, fair elections, and dissent. It began when big money was employed by political operatives such as Roger Stone, a close advisor to Trump, who created negative political advertisements and spread malicious gossip and false narratives, all eagerly amplified by a media devoted to profits and ratings rather than truth, to deceive the public until political debate became burlesque. The ruling elites, terrified by the mobilization of the left in the 1960s, or by what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called America's excess of democracy, built counter-institutions to delegitimize and marginalize critics of corporate capitalism and imperialism. They bought the allegiances of the two main political parties. They imposed obedience to the neoliberal ideology within academia and the press. This campaign, laid out by Lewis Powell in his 1971 memorandum titled Attack on American Free Enterprise System, was the blueprint for the creeping coup d'etat that 45 years later is complete. Our failure to defend the rights of those who are demonized and persecuted leaves us all demonized and persecuted. Our failure to demand justice for everyone leaves us all without justice. Our failure to halt the crushing of popular movements that stand unequivocally with the oppressed leaves us all oppressed. Our failure to protect our democracy leaves us without a democracy. The persecution of the radicals of four decades ago is not ancient history. It is the genesis of the present. It spawned the corporate coup and the machinery of state terror. We will pay for our complacency. We are trapped like rats in a cage. A con artist may be turning the electric shocks on and off, but the problem is the corporate state. And until we dismantle that, we are doomed. Racist, violent, and despotic forces have always been part of the American landscape. They have often been tolerated and empowered by the state to persecute poor people of color and dissidents. These forces are denied absolute power as long as a majority of citizens have a say in their own governance. But once citizens are locked out of government and denied a voice, power shifts into the hands of the enemies of the open society. When democratic institutions cease to function, when the consent of the governed becomes a joke, despots fill the political void. They give vent to popular anger and frustration while arming the state to do to the majority what it has long done to the minority. This tale is as old as civilization. It was played out in ancient Greece and Rome, the Soviet Union, fascist Germany, fascist Italy, and the former Yugoslavia. Once a tiny cabal seizes power, monarchist, communist, fascist, or corporate, it creates a mafia economy and a mafia state. Trump and his coterie of billionaires, generals, half-wits, Christian fascists, criminals, racists, and deviants play the role of the Snopes Klan in some of William Faulkner's novels. The Snopeses fill the power vacuum of the decayed South and ruthlessly seized control from the degenerated former slaveholding aristocratic elites. Flem Snopes and his extended family, which includes a killer, a pedophile, a bigamist, an arsonist, a mentally disabled man who copulates with a cow, and a relative who sells tickets to witness the bestiality, are fictional representations of the moral rot unleashed by unfettered capitalism. The usual reference to amorality, while accurate, is not sufficiently distinctive and by itself does not allow us to place them as they should be placed in a historical moment, the critic Irving Howe wrote of the Snopeses. Perhaps the most important thing to be said is that they are what comes afterwards, the creatures that emerge from the devastation with the slime still upon their lips. Let a world collapse in the South or Russia, and there appear figures of coarse ambition, driving their way up from beneath the social bottom, men to whom moral claims are not so much absurd as incomprehensible, sons of bushwhackers and musics drifting in from nowhere and taking over through the sheer outrageousness of their monolithic force. They become presidents of local banks and chairmen of party regional committees, and later, a trifle slicked up, they muscle their way into Congress or the Politburo. Scavengers without inhibition, they need not believe in the crumbling official code of their society. They need only learn to mimic its sounds. Societies that had democratic traditions are easy prey for the enemies of democracy. Demagogues pay deference to the patriotic ideals, rituals, and practices and forms of the open society while they dismantle it. When the Roman Emperor Augustus, he referred to himself as the first citizen, neutered the Republic, he was careful to maintain the form of the old Republic. Lenin and the Bolsheviks did the same when they seized and crushed the autonomous Soviets. Even the Nazis and the Stalinists insisted they ruled democratic states. Despotic government, as Thomas Paine wrote, is a fungus that grows out of a corrupt civil society. This is what happened to these older democracies. It is what happened to us. Corporations are legally empowered to exploit and loot. It is impossible to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs or ExxonMobil. The pharmaceutical and insurance industries are legally empowered to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. Banks are legally empowered to burden people with student loans that cannot be forgiven by declaring bankruptcy. The animal agriculture industry is legally empowered in many states to charge those who attempt to publicize the conditions in the vast factory farms where diseased animals are warehoused for slaughter with a criminal offense. Corporations are legally empowered to carry out tax boycotts. Free trade deals legally empower global corporations to destroy small farmers and businesses and deindustrialize the country. Government agencies designed to protect the public from contaminated air, water, and food, and from usurious creditors and lenders have been gutted. The Supreme Court, in an inversion of rights worthy of George Orwell, defines unlimited corporate contributions to electoral campaigns as the right to petition the government and a form of free speech. The press, owned by corporations, is an echo chamber for the elites. State and city enterprises and utilities are sold off to corporations that hike rates and deny services. The educational system is being privatized and turned into a species of rote vocational training. Wages are stagnant or have declined. Unemployment and underemployment, masked by falsified statistics, have thrust half the country into chronic poverty. Social services are abolished in the name of austerity. Culture and the arts have been replaced by sexual commodification, banal entertainment, and graphic depictions of violence. The infrastructure, neglected and underfunded, is collapsing. Bankruptcies, foreclosures, food shortages, and untreated illnesses that lead to early death plague a harried underclass. The desperate flee into an underground economy dominated by drugs, crime, and human trafficking. The state, rather than address the economic misery, militarizes police departments and empowers them to use lethal force against unarmed citizens. It fills the prisons with 2.3 million people, only a tiny percentage of whom ever got a trial. And 1 million prisoners now work for corporations inside prisons as modern-day slaves, paid pennies on the dollar without any rights or protection. They are the corporate state's ideal worker. The amendments of the Constitution designed to protect the citizen from tyranny are meaningless. The Fourth Amendment, for example, reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." The reality is that our telephone calls, emails, texts, and financial, judicial, and medical records, along with every website we visit, and our physical travels are tracked, recorded, and stored in perpetuity in government computer banks. The state tortures, not only in black sites such as Bagram or Guantanamo Bay, but in supermax facilities such as the one in Florence, Colorado, where inmates suffer psychological breakdowns from prolonged solitary confinement. Prisoners endure round-the-clock electronic monitoring and 23-hour-a-day lockdowns. They undergo extreme sensory deprivation. They are beaten. They must shower and go to the bathroom on camera. They can write only one letter a week to one relative and cannot use more than three pieces of paper. They often have no access to fresh air and take their 1 hour of daily recreation in a huge cage that resembles a treadmill for hamsters. The state uses special administration measures known as SAMs to strip citizens of their judicial rights. SAMs restrict a citizen's communication with the outside world. They end calls, letters, and visits with anyone except attorneys, and sharply limit contact with family members. Citizens under SAMs are not permitted to see most of the evidence against them because of a legal provision called the Classified Information Procedures Act, or SIPA. SIPA, instituted under the Reagan administration, allows evidence in a trial to be classified. And those who are tried and convicted, like Joseph K. in Franz Kafka's The Trial, can be found guilty without ever seeing the evidence brought against them. And under SAMS, it is against the law for those who have contact with someone held under SAMS, including attorneys, to speak about the physical and psychological conditions being inflicted on the prisoner. When prisoners in our society are released, they have lost the right to vote and receive public assistance. They are burdened with fines that, if unpaid, will put them back behind bars. They are subject to arbitrary searches and arrests. They spend the rest of their lives marginalized as members of a vast criminal caste system. And that is why 76% of those released from state penitentiaries return to prison within 5 years. Our system of mass incarceration, however, is not, as critics charge, broken. It works exactly the way it is designed to work. The bodies of poor people of color do not generate money for corporations on the streets of our deindustrialized cities, but they generate $40,000 or $50,000 a year if we lock them in cages, and that is why they are there. The executive branch of government is empowered to assassinate U.S. citizens. It can call the army into the streets to quell civil unrest under Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, overturning the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibited the military from acting as a domestic police force. The executive branch can order the military to seize U.S. citizens deemed to be terrorists or associated with terrorists, and this is called extraordinary rendition. Those seized can be denied due process and habeas corpus and held indefinitely in military facilities.
Here we must pause Chris Hedges' talk on stopping fascism. We will hear most of the rest of his speech next time on New World Notes. Our audio recording was prepared by Robin Upton of unwelcomeguests.net. Thanks yet again to Robin. Our website is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Peace.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 Wake Up Call.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
The show you're about to hear originally aired in September of 2012. Since the anthrax attacks happened in October of 2001, I thought I would re-air this show. It seems pertinent at this time. So let's begin with the show. Today you'll hear the speech given by Canadian professor Graham McQueen at the conference in Kuala Lumpur in November of 2012, called 9/11 Revisited, Seeking the Truth. Graham McQueen has been actively involved in 9/11 research for many years and was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings that took place on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 in September 2011. The speech you're about to hear was recorded live, and I want to apologize in advance for some of the imperfections in the sound quality that I was unable to edit out. So here he is, Dr. Graham McQueen, talking about anthrax and 9/11.
I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to your wonderful city, my first time here. I want to thank Dr. Mahathir Mohamad for having the courage to raise this issue publicly. I know of no leader in the West who has had that courage. I want to thank the Perdana Global Peace Foundation, not only for putting on this event, but for its ongoing efforts to criminalize war. Now, with that, I would like to begin. As far as we can tell, deception has always been a part of war. Chinese thinker Sun Tzu put it succinctly in his work, The Art of War, which he composed during China's Warring States period about 2,500 years ago. War, he said, is the art of deception. In the 21st century, deception is needed not simply for winning this or that military engagement, but for the preservation of the institution of war itself. War is widely loathed, hated in global society. And we have today international institutions that have the potential to relegate war to the human past. How is it that this ancient and brutal institution raises its head again? The answer is because of deception. When the Cold War ended, a new global conflict formation was put in place, called the Global War on Terror, and in my view, it is thoroughly based on deception. If we care about the well-being of the world's peoples, we must do our best to expose this deception. When we do so, we are placing ourselves within the historic movement for the criminalization and banning of war. I've given today's presentation the title, Fall 2001, The Message, The Terrorists. I want to raise two main questions. What's the message of the terrorists who carried out attacks in the United States in the fall of 2001? And secondly, who are these terrorists? I want to address these questions by dealing briefly with two sets of events that took place in the United States in the fall of 2001, and I believe these two sets of events are connected, even though today we tend to be encouraged to disconnect them. The first set of attacks on civilians occurred on September 11th, the so-called 9/11 attacks that you know about. The second set of attacks are in some sense less worrisome because the casualties were far fewer. In another sense, they are more worrisome because they involve a weapon of mass destruction. How many of you remember that in the fall of 2001, the United States was attacked with a weapon of mass destruction? I am speaking, of course, of the anthrax attacks, which began a week after 9/11, and I'm going to talk about the anthrax attacks for the first half of this presentation. Let me remind you what they were. Beginning in September 18th, letters containing spores of Bacillus anthracis, anthrax, were sent through the U.S. mail system to prominent people in the mass media and to two Democratic senators. The spores had been prepared in a sophisticated way to increase their lethality. In other words, they had been weaponized, and that means this was a biological weapon, and that means it was a weapon of mass destruction. At least seven letters with anthrax were mailed. In the attacks on the senators, each letter contained about 2 grams of anthrax with approximately 1 trillion spores per gram. Robert Stevens died of inhalational anthrax on October 5th, 2001. He was the first of 5 people murdered with this weapon. 22 others were injured. The first military strike on Afghanistan took place 2 days after Stevens' death, and during October, as the anthrax scare intensified and the attack on Afghanistan escalated, the USA Patriot Act was making its way through Congress, being signed into law on October 26th after 2 Democratic senators in a position to obstruct its passage were targeted with anthrax letters. The anthrax attacks were widely reported in the United States and were widely seen as the second blow by the same perpetrators who carried out 9/11, not surprisingly. There is no doubt that the anthrax attack contributed to the atmosphere of fear, and fear is our theme in this session, which facilitated military invasions beginning with Afghanistan and continuing to this day, as well as the restriction of civil rights in the United States and other Western countries, including my own, Canada. Now let us consider briefly my 2 questions. What was the message of the anthrax terrorists, and who were the anthrax terrorists? The anthrax sent to Senators Daschle and Leahy was, fortunately for us, accompanied by text, that is, by actual letters. If we read those letters, we may be able to determine what the message was. These letters are crude and brief, but in my opinion, they are among the most important documents of the 21st century. Please look at them with me. First, date at the top, then this is next. Take penicillin now. Penicillin spelt wrong. Death to America, death to Israel. Allah is great. You see how crude the English of Muslims is. Letter number 2, and this I would really put as one of the most important documents, not only for this session, but of the 21st century. You cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Listen to the taunt to the American population. Are you afraid? Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great. Well, I would summarize the 4 main points implied in these letters as follows. 1, we are Muslims. 2, we are cruel and violent. 3, we intend to kill you. And number 4, we are connected to those who carried out the 9/11 attacks. Look at the date at the top in both of these letters. Not only what is the date, but look at how it is written, 9/11/01. Now, if the word terrorism has any legitimate meaning, this message, accompanied by lethal anthrax spores, is certainly a terrorist message. It credibly threatens violence against civilians. This was not a surprising message. Most of the media in the United States and most political analysts took this link for granted. Of course, this is the second blow by the same people. A group of Muslim extremists, such as Al-Qaeda, was clearly the immediate perpetrator. This hypothesis seemed to fit with the crude English and the primitive method of delivering the anthrax by just putting letters in the mail. But if the English was crude and the means of delivering the anthrax was primitive, what about the anthrax spores in the letters? There was nothing crude about the spores. According to several scientific groups, the anthrax scent, especially that sent to the senators, was one of the most sophisticated preparations of aerosolized anthrax ever seen. So we have crude little letters sent through the mail, and we have this extremely sophisticated anthrax, and it creates a tension in our mind. What's going on? One answer to this dilemma was quickly proposed. While Al-Qaeda may have delivered the anthrax itself must have come from a state source. Guess what that state source was? Iraq, we were told. So here is the theory that emerged. Al-Qaeda, the immediate perpetrator, but behind Al-Qaeda lurks Iraq. And this was the story that was pounded into Americans throughout October by the mass media in the United States. Here, for example, is what the Wall Street Journal had to say in an article about the anthrax attacks published on October 15, 2001. Quote, "Several circumstantial links to Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network are already known, but bin Laden couldn't be doing all this in Afghan caves. The leading supplier suspect has to be Iraq." Just when the campaign against Iraq was fully getting off the ground in October, however, a problem arose. Some of the scientists who examined the anthrax in effect blew the whistle. They said there was no evidence that Iraq or Al-Qaeda had ever gotten a hold of the particular strain of anthrax used. It's called the Ames strain. It was discovered in the wild in the United States. It was cultivated and kept within highly secure laboratories in the United States, shared with a few allies, not shared certainly with Iraq or with Al-Qaeda. Nor was the method of weaponizing the anthrax characteristic of the method used by Iraq, despite the repeated claims of ABC News to the contrary. On the contrary, the method of preparation was closer to U.S. methods than Iraqi methods. This story about Al-Qaeda and Iraq fell apart with remarkable rapidity. By January 2002, Tom Ridge of the recently formed Department of Homeland Security made the acknowledgement public. It appears, he says, that the anthrax in the letters came from a domestic source. What does this mean? You cannot buy this stuff in a drugstore. What Ridge was actually acknowledging was that since the anthrax came from highly secure laboratories serving the U.S. military and intelligence communities, the attacks must have been carried out by, or at least with the assistance of, insiders within these communities. The FBI accepted this conclusion, and it has seldom been challenged since. I'm giving you this because the official story now by the FBI is that this was an inside job. Who then were the terrorists? As it went on the hunt, the FBI began with a strange procedure. It decided that if this was an inside job, it must have been carried out by an individual rather than a group, preferably a mentally unbalanced individual. This is the famous lone nut hypothesis, commonly used in the United States to keep us from asking embarrassing questions. The lone nut eventually elected to fill this position was Bruce Ivins. Dr. Ivins had been working on an anthrax vaccine at the U.S. Army Military Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland. He died, allegedly of a self-administered overdose of Tylenol, a week before being charged with the crime. Therefore, no legal proceeding ever took place. Had it done so, he surely would have been let go, given the nature of the evidence. I have carefully studied the report by the U.S. Department of Justice in which the case against Ivan is made. You can read it yourself. It is found on the Internet. My own conclusion is that Dr. Ivins had nothing to do with this crime. In any case, the most important claim the FBI made, namely that the anthrax in a flax under Ivan's supervision was the parent material for the spores in the letters, has been undercut by a study by the National Research Council in the United States. In a report published in 2011, This group said the FBI's confidence in its scientific methods in linking Ivan's flask to the spores was not justified. In effect, this critique leaves the FBI's case against Ivan's in ruins. I don't have time to develop the argument today about who really did the anthrax attacks and about the links between the anthrax attacks and the 9/11 attacks, although that is a fascinating topic. I have brought up the anthrax attacks today simply to open your minds to a dissenting view of 9/11. My own study shows that these anthrax attacks were not carried out by any individual, mentally unbalanced or otherwise. They were carried out by a group. This group was not mentally unbalanced. It was sane. It was rational. And it nested and still nests in the heart of the U.S. military and intelligence communities. Therefore, if I may sum up this part of my talk, we know, I believe, that beginning 1 week after 9/11, insiders in the military and intelligence communities of the United States collaborated in killing U.S. citizens, in targeting two U.S. senators, in terrorizing their own nation, and in framing Muslims, who, it turns out, had nothing to do with those absurd letters. Now let us move to 9/11. We have 11 years of research on 9/11. We have many critiques of the official story. I myself am involved in about three major initiatives to sort through the evidence and find the best. I'm not going to talk about them at length, but they're listed in my bio there. The 9/11 Consensus Panel, the Toronto Hearings on 9/11, and the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And you can find all three of these on the Internet. In the meantime, however, my time is short. Let me briefly ask the two same questions I asked about the anthrax attacks. What is the message of the 9/11 terrorists, and who are those terrorists? In the case of 9/11, we weren't sent a letter, as we were in the anthrax case, so we need to be able to interpret the lethal theater, the dramatic actions of the attacks themselves.
You're about to hear the World Trade Center South Tower coming down. This is the actual audio, and you can time it. It takes approximately 11 seconds for this entire building to collapse. Imagine this whole 110-story building collapsing in just 11 seconds. And here it is.
Okay, the paradigmatic event. If you had been standing underneath the tower at the time that that happened, you would be a traumatized person. But what else could you say? You could say you were in the presence of extreme violence, but you would have no narrative. You wouldn't know who did it, how they did it, or anything else. In order to know that, you needed to be guided in your interpretation by media personalities and by political leaders, and that began on 9/11 itself. We were told these planes were hijacked, probably by people in bin Laden's organization. We were told the hijackers took over the planes and flew them themselves into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon as a form of suicide attack. Now, you must realize that U.S. citizens were already prepared over a period of years by their media to interpret the events in the sky as an attack by Muslims. Both airplane hijacking and suicide attacks were already associated in their minds with Muslims. You may protest that this is an oversimplification of history, and you would be right, but it is also irrelevant. What matters here is what the beliefs were in the minds of American citizens. The beliefs were that these were uniquely Muslim forms of activity. Therefore, the message required no letter. The message was written across the sky and transmitted by television into every living room in the United States, and that message was, we are Muslims, we are cruel and violent, and we intend to kill you. And that is the message that lies at the heart of the global war on terror and the demonization of Islam. And now I proceed to the second and more difficult question, which my colleagues a little bit earlier went into in more detail than I'm going to be able to do. Who are these terrorists? I want, rather than trying to give a lot of detailed information, to to simply say to you, how do we proceed when we want to answer that question? And I want to emphasize that our conclusions must not be based on ideology, prejudice, or belief. They must be based on evidence. Evidence. That's what many of us have been trying day after day for years to gather and to sort through. If we are wrong, we stand ready to be corrected. But we cannot be shown to be wrong through ridicule, moral outrage, or arguments from authority. We must be shown to be wrong through evidence. I believe the evidence we have gathered over 11 years is strong in both quality and quantity. And I believe that one set of evidence strongly corroborates another set of evidence. And really, in my remaining moments, I want to give you an example of that by concentrating on one form of evidence that Richard Gage mentioned in his presentation, the eyewitness evidence. The eyewitnesses at the World Trade Center who say they perceived these towers being torn apart by explosions. Bear in mind, please, that the official account has no room for such explosions. If these explosions took place and were indeed the result of planned explosive demolition, the official count of 9/11 is finished. Hence the importance of this evidence. Now I'm going to show you two brief video clips to show you what I mean by detailed corroboration. First, however, this little graph of 156 eyewitnesses. I have personally gathered together 156 accounts, previously 118, now expanded to 156, and have published 118 of them. Hopefully the 156 will be published soon. I want to assure you that I used careful methods in compiling this list. If somebody says they heard a big boom in the World Trade Center, that's not enough to get on my list. If they say they heard an explosion, it gets on the list. They must use certain terms in order to get on here. We have 156 eyewitnesses, and this is not even a comprehensive count. What I'm saying is, in a general sense, we have a great deal of corroboration here. But let's look at a specific case. This first clip was shown to you by Richard, and I'm going to look at it again.
We made it outside. We made it about a block.
We made it at least two blocks, and we started running. Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like, it was if it had detonated.
Detonated.
If they were planned to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
All the way down. I was watching it and running.
Just ran up west.
And then you just...
Okay, what do we see? First of all, we hear two firefighters, Pat Zoda and Dennis Tardio of the Fire Department of New York, corroborating each other's testimony, nodding, saying, yes, that's what we saw. Yes, we were looking directly at the towers. They not only do that, but they give a particular hand gesture. Starts with Pat Zoda, confirmed by Dennis Tardio, and this is what they say. Zoda, floor by floor, it started popping out. Tardio, it was as if they had detonated. Detonated, you know, as if they were planted to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom. Confirmed by Zoda, yeah. Now, my question is, they are corroborating each other, but is there anyone else who is completely independent from these witnesses who gives a detailed confirmation, a detailed corroboration of this? And there are many. I don't have time to read them all, but here's an example. This fellow is Paul Lemos. On 9/11, he was in the vicinity of the World Trade Center participating in the filming of a commercial. He was interviewed on videotape on 9/11 near World Trade Center. You can actually see World Trade Center 7 in the background when he's talking, so it's obviously before 5:20 in the afternoon. Here's what's important. He was filmed by a different filmmaker, a different time, different location from the firefighters, and this is entirely independent testimony. Now, I want you to listen to what he says about what he saw and to look at his gestures when he describes it. Just like the two firefighters, he is talking about the destruction of the North Tower, World Trade Center 1.
Can you tell us your name?
My name's Paul Lemos. All of a sudden, I looked up, and about 20 stories below, at least that's what it looked like to me, about 75 flights up below the fire, I saw from the corner. Boom, 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 boom. Just like 20 straight hits. Just went down, and then I just saw the whole building just went, and as the bombs were going, people just started running, and I sat there and watched a few of them explode, and then I just turned around, and I just started running for my life, because at that point, World Trade Center was coming right down, right above us.
We see the same hand gesture, a series of little karate chops, which clearly indicate separate energetic bursts starting near the top and coming down at systematically at regular intervals. And we hear the words. All of a sudden, I looked up, and about 20 stories below the fire, I saw from the corner, boom, 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 just like 20 straight hits, just went down, and then I just saw the whole building just went, pshhh. And as the bombs, he does not hesitate to use the word, were gone, people started running, and I sat there and watched a few of them explode, and then I just turned around and I started running for my life, because at that point, the World Trade Center was coming right down. My friends, this is what we mean by corroboration. These are very rich eyewitness accounts, and we have many, many others, as I've said. Now, I'm aware that my time is running out, so let me go on to say this. On what basis can I, as a researcher, reject what Pat Zoda and Dennis Tardio and Paul Lemos have said? On what basis can I reject the accounts of the other 153 witnesses? They were there, I wasn't. What should I think when I discovered that both the 9/11 Commission and the National Institute of Technology in their reports have somehow missed all 156 eyewitnesses? What should I conclude when I discover that these eyewitness accounts are further corroborated, as Mr. Gage has shown, by entirely different kinds of evidence, evidence of extremely high temperatures, of explosive residue, and so on? What should I do when proponents of the official account tell me to accept violations of the laws of physics? Surely in such a case, I have to say, however distressing the implications, I must honor this evidence, and I must insist on a thorough investigation of these incidents, which is precisely what I do insist on. It seems to me that a great and grievous deception took place on 9/11. As we work to uncover this deception, and I will be concluding with this, I suggest we keep in mind UN Security Council Resolution 1368, which was passed by the Security Council on September 12, 2001, the day after these attacks. I'm sure many of you know this resolution was used by the party of war to legitimize the invasion of Afghanistan. It's time the party of peace used it for a different purpose. The resolution says that the Security Council unequivocally condemns in the strongest terms the horrifying terrorist attacks which took place on 11 September 2001, and it goes on to say that the Security Council calls on all states to work together urgently to bring to justice the perpetrators, organizers, and sponsors of these terrorist attacks, and stresses that those responsible for aiding, supporting, or harboring the perpetrators, organizers, and sponsors of these attacks will be held accountable. And that is what we're trying to do. Thank you.
And again, that was Canadian Professor Graham McQueen at the 9/11 conference in Kuala Lumpur in November of 2012. To see the video of this speech or others from the conference, you can go to YouTube and search for 9/11 and Kuala Lumpur. This speech was given in 2012, and since then, Dr. Graham McQueen has actually written a book on the anthrax attacks called The 2001 Anthrax Deception, A Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. And I'd highly recommend it. It came out, in 2014. And it can be ordered at your local bookstore. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
listening to Building Bridges. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Greg Pallett is a veteran election investigator who has continued to uncover the sickening truth of widespread systematic election rigging, robbing African American, Hispanic, and Asian American voters of their right to vote in crucial states. Pallett is known for complex undercover investigations spanning five continents, from the Arctic to the Amazon, from Caracas to California, using the skills he learned over two decades as a top investigative corporate fraud reporter. Pallett is the author of several New York Times bestsellers, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Vultures, Picnic and Armed Madhouse. And we are joined by Greg Pallett, but we want to begin first by going straight to Georgia. And we begin with Martin Luther King's cousin, 92 years old, who claims she was blocked by Kemp from casting a vote.
Has this ever happened to you before?
Never.
How long have you been voting?
All my life, ever since I was old enough. But I've been voting right here ever since 1968.
And it's horrible. And I say that because the West End, she's been in this community back when we could, when they were doing sit-ins. She held civil rights meetings at her home. And today to come out and not be able to vote and no one can give you an explanation, like, it's extremely emotional and it bothers me. It bothers me to my core. Like, there's actually no record of her whatsoever voting in any election whatsoever, and it's ridiculous.
And now we are joined by Greg Pallett. And we actually took that sound from Greg Pallett's website. Greg, so the question is, notwithstanding the rhetoric of the Republicans in Florida, who has been tampering with our elections? Is there voting fraud going on, as you have investigated and seen it? And let's first start in Georgia.
Okay. You know, voters, dead voters, people voting double, all that stuff, they haven't shown one single case, but I can tell you this. Before the election, I sued Brian Kemp. That is my Pallett Investigative Fund, sued Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, who's running the election and was also the guy running for governor. He had removed 500,000 voters from the voter rolls in 2017, the year before the election, without any notice. No one knows that they lost their vote, 500,000 voters. And then I took that list and I got four top consulting firms to go through the list. Said about 400,000 people supposedly left Georgia or moved out of their congressional district. So I got the experts to look up everyone's true address, which they can do. They look at the Georgia power bills, the DMV records, the Georgia taxes, your phone bill, et cetera. All stuff actually that Brian Kemp should have done. But he threw these people off the voter rolls saying that they had moved, overwhelmingly voters of color. And here's what we found. 340,134 voters were wrongly purged, at least that much. There may be 100,000 more, but we know of 340,000. So, one, they didn't get voter cards. They didn't know where to go to vote, so a lot of them probably didn't vote because of that. Second, we had tens of thousands show up at the voter stations and saying, here's where I always vote. I didn't get a card, but what happened? Oh, you've been purged. You can't vote. Then two things happened. In some cases, like I went with a Rahim Shabazz, who a lot of Georgians went to gregpallett.com, my website, because I put up the purge list. You could look up whether you were purged or not. So people found they were purged. I said, let me know. So I went with Rahim Shabazz, a great filmmaker out of Atlanta. So he demanded and got a provisional ballot. Whether it will be counted or not, we don't know. That's what Stacey Abrams' lawyers are fighting over, the counting of those ballots. By the way, it was then, when I was with Rahim at the polling station, that we found Christine Jordan, who is Martin Luther King's cousin. She's 92 years old. She was really dressed up for voting, as she does because it's so important. She's been voting at the same station since her cousin was murdered in 1968. And they purged her. And you heard the distraught voice saying, this bothers me. That's her granddaughter. And if you go to gregpallett.com, I want you to see that 92-year-old woman lose her vote.
This is what's happening. We are back to Jim Crow. This is her 50th year of voting. We thought it was all over after the Voting Rights Act, after King was killed. We thought that you still get to vote. Not in Georgia. It's going backwards. And then there are people who are given refused provisional ballots. Now, this is a big thing. Under the federal law, if you've been purged wrongly, you can say, I'm supposed to be a voter. I'm supposed to be on those voter rolls. And you can fill out a provisional ballot. Then they can make a determination later. Brian Kemp let out the word, and all these counties were accepting this ridiculous concept that if you're not on the voter rolls, you can't get a provisional ballot. So it's a catch-22. They throw you off the voter rolls illegally, and you can't cast a provisional ballot to protest it because they say, well, you're not on the voter rolls. Well, no kidding. That's why we're trying to fill out this ballot. So this is the games that they're playing in Georgia with literally 100,000 votes. Stacey Abrams not only should be getting a rerun, she really probably won it outright. If you count all the votes, they also disqualified 5,000 absentee ballots, mail-in ballots. Why? They said, oh, suspect signature. Well, a suspect signature means that someone else filled out that ballot and stole the ballot. Well, if that's true, go and arrest people. Go call the cops. They're not calling the cops. They're just throwing out ballots. Are there really 5,000 fraudulent voters? They haven't claimed one. They're just throwing out the ballot, saying, well, the signature doesn't match. We say so. No, the whole point of the signature match issue is that to prevent fraud. And there's no fraud going on here. They're not saying that any of these voters were not legal voters. They're just saying, and by the way, never, never, never mail in your ballot. Don't go postal. Never mail in a ballot, ever. Just don't do it, because it's not just Georgia. It's also New York, just to let you know.
Hmm.
And California is one of the worst. So even if you fill out the ballot absentee, take it in to the to a county clerk or wherever. But this is a game that's being played in Georgia. It's the worst in Georgia. But what makes it so different, Mimi, so different, is that Stacey Abrams has done something no Democrat's ever done, saying, I'm not conceding. I'm going to make them count all the votes. You know, Gillum, the Democrat candidate in Florida, conceded before the votes were counted. He was ahead and he was conceding. Then he took back his concession, but that may finish him off, because remember, they're fighting over these ballots. They're fighting over the absentee ballots. They're fighting over the provisional ballots. And once he conceded, that his team start going home and the Republicans just start tossing out ballots. And, you know, you don't have to be a genius. You don't have to, like, be Carnac the Great and know what's inside a provisional ballot envelope or an absentee ballot envelope. I know that my daughter faced down a challenge in Savannah for her absentee ballot. They know that young students in Savannah, Georgia, a highly Democratic area, are all voting Stacey Abrams. They don't have to look inside the envelope. They know that if you're in Fulton County side of Atlanta, that's a Stacey Abrams vote. You know, Macon, Georgia, they're going to count that vote. That's the game.
Greg, what was the process by which these votes were purged in Georgia?
The purge of voters happened. Okay, they pulled a trick. And by the way, this is in the town of the New York Times. The Times has asked me for my information, and they kind of disappeared. You know, don't count on the Times to cover this story. They're lazy. They wrote a story saying that back in June, the Supreme Court said that the Ohio Republican Secretary of State was allowed to remove voters because they didn't vote. In other words, if they made them inactive and then they canceled them. You miss two elections and you lose your right to vote. That's not true. That's not what the court said. That's a direct violation of federal law, which says in the National Voter Registration Act of 93, no voter can lose their vote, their registration without for not voting. You cannot lose your registration for not voting. That's the law, okay? So how did people get removed because they skipped a couple elections, as a lot of people do? The answer is, they're saying, well, that's evidence you've moved. You've moved away. And they send you a postcard. Now, a postcard looks like junk mail. And it doesn't go to everyone. It's overwhelmingly going to students, identified people who move, like apartment dwellers who move usually within the town or whatever. And you don't have to re-register if you move within your county. You should, because so you don't get your vote stolen, but you don't have to under federal law. So you cannot remove people for skipping an election. But they say that's evidence you've moved. They send you a postcard. Oh, well, that's proof you didn't move because you didn't return the postcard. And they remove people. Or you were on something called the Interstate Cross Check, was created by the right-wing white supremacist Chris Kobach, who lost his election for governor of Kansas, but he's run this voter purging operations for Brian Kemp in Georgia and for 25 other states. 25 states, he sends them hit lists of hundreds of thousands of voters who he says moved because, and you'll dig this, they say, oh, well, they know someone's moved because, you know what, they found James Brown in Atlanta and a James Brown in Motown, Detroit, believe it or not. And they said, obviously, it's the same James Brown. I got to hold these lists, different middle names. James Brown Sr., James Brown Jr. put down as the same voter. But what they do is they say, oh, well, that person's moved because there's two James Browns in two towns. And then they begin the process of removing that voter from the voter rolls. This is how they are doing it. And I can tell you right now the Democratic Party has said nothing about it. I can tell you right now that that's why you can't count on the Democratic Party to save African-American voters. When I say Democratic Party, let me correct that. Stacey Abrams, as you heard, is really tough on this. She's in federal court. She's fighting this purge game. But it's not a coincidence that she's African-American, because the problem is not the Democratic Party per se. It's the Democratic white congressional caucus.
And there's another ingredient to this whole peculiarity of using what you've called, and some other people as well, the purge by postcard trick. And that yes. is that built into that is a serious racial bias. And I wonder if you could ferret yeah. that out for us.
Yes. So what we did was, oh, for example, you send a postcard to people to see if they've moved. Now dig this. The chance that a white, elderly, suburban homeowner will get a government postcard, because you don't always get them, get the card and return it, is 500% higher than if you're a young, black, urban renter. 500% difference. So in other words, they know that if they send out postcards and people return them and say, okay, you can vote, if you don't return them, you lose your vote, they know who it's going to hit. It's going to hit black people. It's going to hit students. Like my daughter, she's a Georgia voter. Now, she's a student. So she doesn't necessarily even get these notices because she's moving from one dorm or apartment to the next. And, you know, she's 21, so she, you know, mail? What's mail? I mean, she checks her mailbox at her school once a year because they require it. That's it. Young people do not look at these things. It looks like junk mail anyway, but people in urban areas, especially African Americans and poor people and stuff, they don't return this mail unless it's pretty clear that it's something that they have to return. They don't just start giving away their names and addresses. Signing things, you know. So you have this type of split. And, of course, you have cards going out to people who speak Spanish, hooray, in English, right? And there's no, you know, of course, and our experts that we hired said, this is insane. First of all, you're also sending them to voters just because they have a common name like James Brown. And the fact is, as the Brennan Center for Justice cited my work in their lawsuits in Georgia and Common Cause, saying 85 of the 100 most common names in the United States are minority names. Brown, Johnson, Kim, Hernandez, Garcia, Lee, etc. So if you're using a common name match system to so-called hunt for double voters or move voters or whatever, so the whole process starts with catching people who, voters of color, postcards capture young people, voters of color and students, and even using, you know, a trigger of like skipping an election. As you well know in New York, and I have this in Los Angeles, in my ballot, I mean, I voted, but it was kind of symbolic. I'm in an all-Democratic area in California. Most of the positions, there were no competitors. Basically, all the races in California are locked. I mean, there's actually literally no reason to vote. So if I skipped it, well, under the Brian Kemp, Chris Kobach GOP system, I'd lose my next vote. But I wouldn't know it until I tried to vote. That's what they're doing. Nice if the New York Times would report it. Hello?
Gregor, any of these practices themselves illegal? Are they being challenged in court to overturn the election?
Those are two different questions. Are they illegal and are they being challenged?
Right.
Yes, they are illegal. I mean, I just got off the phone with my attorney, Jeannie Meyer, in New York. Hello, Jeannie.
And she's fantastic. And one of the really great New York City Lawyers Guild lawyers who's been working
absolutely.
On this issue.
Well, I'm glad you – thank you. She deserves all that.
She certainly
props.
Does.
And she is my national lawyer on all 26 cases. We have great lawyers in each of the states. But it's pretty clear. It says that you can only purge voter rolls to make them more accurate. Well, when you're purging the names of voters for moving and they haven't moved, that doesn't make them more accurate. That just makes them whiter. That is illegal on two grounds. One, it violates the National Voter Registration Act on its face. And two, it violates the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment by making it racial, by having whether it's a racial intent, they can claim it's not racial. But believe me, they know what they're doing. If they were removing people from white country clubs, believe me, it would stop in a second. So is it illegal? Yes. Who's doing something about it? Well, number one, don't expect the federal government to act because, I mean, you just got this guy Whitaker. I mean, it was bad enough to have Jeff Beauregard Sessions. Now we've fallen over the right cliff. So and he's running this civil rights, voting rights division. These are the voting cops. They're not going to, and so you have to call the voting cops, and they don't respond. They lock you up. And so the government doesn't do it, so we have to do it by lawsuits. And my team, Jeannie Myers, already sued Brian Kemp.
And, of course, we should say also that Jeannie Myers also insists, and I agree with her completely, that the National Voting Registration Act explicitly prohibits state voting officials from purging voters simply for not voting in any event.
That is correct. You cannot do it. So this is a case that we are making to get the information, which we now have a lot of. We know of the wrongful votes there, and we're going across the country to Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, and other states. But to expose this game, in terms of the substantive, what we call those are informational, because I'm a journalist, so I mainly try to get the information. But now that I've got the information, the NAACP, Common Cause, the Abrams Campaign, and several others are gearing up to sue the state of Georgia. And I'm hoping this will be the first cases that will go around the country, because Kemp's not alone, is in the state of Georgia. You're having a lot of groups saying, this stops now. Put these people back on the rolls. That's where we're heading in litigation. It's going to be tough because, you know, in case you're unaware, it's now the Kavanaugh Court. No smart lawyer wants to be caught either in a bedroom or a courtroom with Brett Kavanaugh. And so we're working on ways to try to be able to make these points without ending up in the Supreme Court.
You know, one of the other things that, of course, is just appalling and problematic, the issue that you have of President Donald Trump, for example, who you've pointed out in your writings, warns a rally in Macon, Georgia, in the Deep South, that Stacey Abrams is running to become the first black female governor in the U.S. history, quote, and is one of the most extreme far-left politicians in the entire country, adding that, you know that, Stacey, if she's in there, you're going to have Georgia run into Venezuela. Now, yes. This is just extraordinary. And you also point out that, of course, there were rallies by various white supremacist, neo-Nazi organizations.
Well, they were one rally. Let me make a correction.
Oh, that's
there.
Nice. They all were rally. Harmonizing.
It's the same. See, when I went, I kind of snuck into the Trump rally. We had some press pool passes, but
with your hat and your look, you managed
in? No. Are you kidding?
Oh, I was wondering.
I'm a coward. I'm not going to start running into a bunch of white supremacists.
Okay, so you're not going to play a Michael Moore. Okay.
Well, I mean, yeah, because if you've got a lot of guards with you, yeah. I mean, this is no joke. This isn't going up against some guy in a tie in a corporate office. You have to understand, when I was at the Trump rally and I was not dressed as I usually am, in fact, if you go to gregpalace.com, you can see my story. I'm at the Trump rally in Macon, Georgia. So behind me is Air Force One, and I'm taking a selfie with a Proud Boy. I mean, these are the violent white supremacists. They are proud of their violence. And so they are scary dudes. You had QAnon, 3%ers, you know, the InfoWars guys, and QAnon. You have to understand, these are like really scary. And they weren't in the crowd. They were the crowd. I want to repeat that. That's important. Most of the people, 4,000 people show up to see Donald Trump, and the majority were in the ultra-right and white suprematist connected organizations. That's the majority of the people that were there. I kid you not. It was nasty. It was frightening. You know, they're having a good time, but and then it was only at the end. Thank God I was outside the rally, you know, like kind of far away, and so there's just a scattering of their people. And one woman pointed to me, even my pseudo-disguise, saying, there is that terrible man from Noonan. Just so you know, at Noonan, Georgia, I confronted Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State slash candidate, when he got off his campaign bus. I followed his campaign bus, and when I got to him, you know, as a reporter, now I am a recognizable reporter, and I have a microphone in his face saying, Mr. Kemp, why are you purging black voters? Is this to win the gubernatorial election? And why do I have to sue you in federal court to get to the list of the purge people? And I start getting grabbed by people. Then before I know it, I'm grabbed by two guys in Smokey the Bear hats who throw me off the property. And I do say, wait, am I the only reporter being removed? And they say, they said just you. So that was, while the Atlanta Journal-Constitution did not cover any of the substance of my investigation of purge of voters in Georgia, they covered none of it. They did cover the little bit where I'm being thrown out by Brian Kemp's goons.
Well, let's move while we have the time from Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin and her granddaughter, Jessica Lawrence, we heard a brief clip from, to Florida, where now the great irony is that, of course, the rhetoric of the Trumpites is that there is indeed voter fraud, and that is coming from the Democrats. What's your observation about what actually has been happening now in Florida?
Well, I was exhausted, but I sent my team has to take my orders even if they haven't slept. So they went down the great.
You're
Zach
becoming
Roberts.
Very hierarchical and very authoritarian.
Yes, they're very kind. They're all enthusiastic. They're younger. You know, like Zach D. Roberts is a famous investigative photojournalist. He took those pictures of that you saw in Democracy Now! in Charlottesville, that teacher DeAndre Harris being beaten nearly to death. That was Zach, who had a gun in his face. So he's used to dealing with these guys. So he went down to Florida, and what they were sending back to me, the film we're looking at, is of white supremacists trying to shut down the vote. And there were some Democrats, mostly African Americans, who were demonstrating count the vote. They were chanting, count the votes, count all the votes. And the white supremacists started chanting, not all votes count, not all votes count. And they're right, in Florida, not all votes count. And we're seeing new games. For example, Rick Scott tags people as illegal aliens. In order for you to vote, you as an American citizen whose only crime is having the last name Rodriguez have to go into a federal court and prove you're a citizen. And by the way, that's not so easy. Your Social Security card, your driver's license, that's not citizenship proof. You have to have an original birth certificate or a passport. Military service, forget it. If you have your military records, we have non-citizens who serve in the U.S. military hoping that one day they'll become citizens. You can't use your military records or IDs. This is the game that Rick Scott is playing there. They are trying to stop the count of the provisional ballots. We talked about these kind of placebo ballots that were given out where if your name is missing from the voter rolls, you get to at least fill out a piece of paper, but then they throw it away. So I call it a placebo ballot because you think you voted, and there's a good chance you haven't. This is a second-class ballot. They're using that in Florida. They're discounting again absentee ballots, that is mail-in ballots that they're challenging the signatures on, which is ridiculous. And then I even found I'm getting messages from people that they're being thrown off the voter rolls because supposedly they are ex-cons, and it's not true. And they're removing people so with common minority names.
And one of the things that also I thought was extraordinary, which going back to Georgia, was that you found that Kemp was actually working in secret coordination with Chris Kobach Kansas. And this was of great concern to Stacey Abrams when you revealed that to her.
Yes.
And these new legal actions reveal that Kobach supplied 108,000 of the names that Kemp purged, and purged in secret.
In secret, he purged 108,000 people that were on the list that Chris Kobach of Kansas gave him. and supposedly on the grounds that they left the state of Georgia. My experts went through name by name, and they've got special agreements, by the way. We have a special firms of special agreements with the post office, as well as other 200 database providers. And they said 106,000 of the 108,000 never moved. But he still used this racist list from Chris Kobach. And I have to say, when I say racist, I'm not guessing. I work with a Rolling Stone magazine. We hired a bunch of experts who went through the list, and it's just a Jim Crow list. It's all these common names. It's just James Brown and Maria Hernandez.
Greg, I really thank you for your salient, comprehensive, and dangerous work in uncovering the voting fraud that has been stealing the votes. We want to thank you so much for the work you do.
You know, if people want to continue to follow, go to gregpalace.com. We're going to have more film from Florida and from Georgia starting tonight.
And I insist that you do. It's really important. Thanks. We've been speaking to crack investigative sleuth on voting-based issues and corporate fraud, Greg Palast.
And now let's hear from Stacey Abrams,
Democratic candidate for governor in Georgia.
When you chose me as your Democratic nominee, I made you a vow. In our Georgia, no one would be unseen, no one is unheard, and no one is uninspired. Because in Georgia, civil rights has always been an act of will and a battle for our souls. And because we have been fighting this fight since our beginnings, we have learned a fundamental truth. Democracy only works when we work for it, when we fight for it, when we demand it. And apparently today, when we stand in lines for hours to meet it at the ballot box, that's when democracy works. But I'm here tonight to tell you, votes remain to be counted. There are voices that are waiting to be heard. Across our state, folks are opening up the dreams of voters in absentee ballots. And we believe our chance for a stronger Georgia is just within reach. Because I'll tell you this, in a civilized nation, the machinery of democracy should work for everyone everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day. This election has tested our faith. I'm not going to name names, but some have worked hard to take our voices away, to scare us away, to distract us. But if our vision is clear and we see the finish line. But I want to say this. If I wasn't your first choice, or if you made no choice at all, you're going to have a chance to do a do-over. So let's get it done. Thank you so much.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Tonight, right here in Colorado, we proved that no barrier should stand in the way of pursuing our dream.
We all will continue to
strive to make a better Vermont, and nothing is impossible when you're on the side of justice.
Vote yes on 3.
And protect Massachusetts kids like me.
For all of you out there that can't handle the fact that I'm about to become the first openly gay person to hold statewide office.
We are better as a country than where we find ourselves today. We all know it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Scotland puts queer culture in the books. Election anxiety kills an LGBTQ Christian forum in Armenia. And a rainbow-hued blue wave brightens the U.S. midterms. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 10th, 2018. The government of Scotland claimed this week that it's the first country on the planet to require queer-inclusive content in history and other social studies curriculum in every public school, without exception. The action was prompted by a study conducted by the Time for Inclusive Education campaign, which found that 9 of 10 LGBTQ students reported experiencing homophobia on campus, and 27% said it drove them to attempt suicide. In the same study, 4 of 5 teachers said that they don't feel that they've been adequately trained to combat homophobia, and very few teachers or students are aware of the challenges that intersex people face. Jordan Daly, co-founder of the Time for Inclusive Education campaign, called it a monumental victory that sends a strong and clear message to LGBTI young people that they are valued here in Scotland. The Christian Institute's Simon Calvert joined the few dissenting voices, charging that LGBTQ people are radical and intolerant of traditional religious views. But Education Secretary John Swinney disagreed. Our education system must support everyone to reach their full potential, he said. That is why it is vital that the curriculum is as diverse as the young people who learn in our schools. The UK's infamous Section 28, which outlawed the intentional promotion of homosexuality in public schools, was only repealed in Scotland in 2000 and in Britain and Wales in 2003.
But Armenia's police chief, Valerie Osipyan, forced the cancellation this week of an LGBTQ Christian forum in the capital city of Yerevan, organized by the NGO New Generation, after it had become a political football ahead of next month's elections. "I don't consider it appropriate to hold the forum in Armenia," the Eurasian country's top cop said, considering the risks and security considerations. The conference was announced in August, using a gospel verse as the theme. "The spirit of our forum is love in Christ, which knows no boundaries, be it country, denomination, gender, or anything else." But in succeeding weeks, the 4-day forum that was scheduled to kick off on November 15th became the subject of heated debate in Parliament. Kerakin II, the Armenian Orthodox Church's top leader, called same-gender sex a sin. The denomination claims the vast majority of the country's population. The government of Levon Petrosyan would prefer that the issue not complicate the president's high approval ratings ahead of the elections. "It's a headache," he said. Forum organizers cited constant threats and organized intimidation in their November 6th cancellation announcement. They pointed to 13 similar events they've held across the region with no trouble and said that they didn't expect any in Yerevan. They asked people of faith to pray for the LGBTI persons in Armenia, their safety, freedom, and rights.
Homophobia is making headlines again in Indonesia. Government and religious officials in the predominantly Muslim nation's most populous province, West Java, called last month for the arrest and rehabilitation of LGBTQ people. 2 men in the provincial capital of Bandung were detained soon thereafter in a police raid of their home. They were charged with distributing indecent material online because of their Facebook page for same-gender couples that some reports described as a gay hookup site. There were also local news reports that provincial police in Lampung had been harassing trans women. 10 women accused of deviant lesbian behavior were arrested in Padang, the provincial capital of West Sumatra, on November 4th. Police officials said that the allegations were based on social media photos of some of them hugging and kissing like men and women. They range in age from 23 to 31. According to Human Rights Watch, police across the country in 2017 raided saunas, nightclubs, hotel rooms, hair salons, and private homes on suspicion that gay or transgender people were inside. At least 300 people were detained because of their perceived sexual orientation or gender identity, the highest number ever recorded in Indonesia. People have been publicly flogged for same-gender sex in Aceh, the only province allowed by the theoretically secular federal government to fully enforce Sharia or strict Islamic law. Same-gender sex is not specifically against the law in Indonesia, at least not yet. So the 10 accused lesbians in Padang will be sent to the Office of Social Services for what officials ominously described as guidance. Federal government authorities created a task force in February to stop the LGBT disease.
The crackdown on LGBTQ people apparently continues unabated in Tanzania. The federal government has disavowed last week's announcement by Dar es Salaam Governor Paul Makonda that all homosexuals would be arrested, urging citizens to report suspects to the police. Some media outlets last week said that people's homes were already being raided ahead of the announced November 5th start of the roundup, and that panic was spreading across the country, not just in Dar es Salaam. Tanzania's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that the Eastern African nation will continue to abide by the Constitution and to respect human rights treaties it has signed. That didn't satisfy the European Union, which has recalled its ambassador. And the U.S. Embassy in Tanzania issued a warning to American citizens in the country to carefully review their social media profiles to avoid being caught up in the crackdown. 10 men were arrested at a beach resort on the Tanzanian island of Zanzibar on November 3rd and charged with being part of a same-gender wedding ceremony. According to The Guardian, they each faced forced anal exams. Several human rights groups call the medically discredited procedure to supposedly discover evidence of homosexual activity torture. All of the men were released on bail on November 8th, but they face further proceedings. It's not clear whether or not the invasive anal exams had been or will be conducted. Same-gender sex is illegal in Tanzania under a colonial-era penal code that punishes offenders with up to 25 years in prison.
In better news for LGBTQ people, a rainbow-tinted blue wave swept Democrats into the governing majority in the U.S. House of Representatives in midterm elections held on November 6th. A record number of LGBTQ candidates, women, and people of color were elected, including the country's first openly gay man elected to a state governorship, Colorado's Jared Polis, and the re-election of bisexual Oregon Governor Kate Brown and trailblazing lesbian U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin. However, Vermont Democrat Christine Hultquist, who had already made history as the first transgender nominee of a major political party, lost her bid for governor. But Massachusetts voters soundly approved anti-bias protections for transgender people, the only LGBTQ-related measure on the midterms ballot. A Kansas congressional district elected the country's first Native American lesbian to the U.S. House. An Indiana district elected its first openly gay state legislator. Michigan has the state's first out lesbian attorney general. And Guam elected its first openly gay lieutenant governor. A few critical races remain too close to call as we record this newscast. But few tears are being shed in the queer community over the loss in her bid for re-election of notorious marriage certificate-denying Kentucky clerk Kim Davis. We'll have extended coverage and analysis of the rainbow-hued U.S. midterm elections following News Wrap on most of these same This Way Out stations.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump's efforts to erase transgender people from U.S. anti-bias protections seem to be going nowhere. More than 50 transnational companies, ranging from Facebook and Google and Chase Bank to both Pepsi and Coca-Cola, have issued a business statement for transgender equality opposing the Trump agenda. 9 Nobel Prize winners were among more than 1,600 scientists signing an open letter calling on the Trump administration to abandon its trans erasure plans and almost 100 soon-to-be in-the-majority House Democrats have signed on to their own letter telling Trump to back off.
And finally, proudly gay retired Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby is being dragged kicking and screaming down the aisle by his longtime partner, Johan van Vloten. Well, not literally. The lifelong champion of human rights first announced that he was boycotting last year's marriage equality postal plebiscite, though he later changed his mind and said he voted yes. But because we've been together now for 49 years and 8 months, he said, marriage just seemed a little artificial. It seemed a little late for the confetti. And it also seemed to us a little bit patriarchal. But he said the long-term spouses, he insists that they won't call each other husband and husband, decided to bow to what has now become convention. We ultimately decided that we are going to get married on the 50th anniversary of our meeting, Kirby said, which is the 11th of February, 2019. It'll be at home, not in the since-torn-down hotel bar where they met. But he said they'd go back the next day to what is now a bustling bistro and ask for a table. Is that weird? He asked. He answered his own question. No, he said. I think it's a bit romantic.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending November 10th, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the continuously updated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
According to the LGBTQ Candidate Supporting Victory Fund, there were at least 225 queer contenders in local, state, and federal elections across the U.S. in the November 6th midterm elections. Ballots in a few high-profile races are still being counted as we record this program, with razor-thin margins separating the potential winners and losers. A number of firsts characterized the record-breaking crop of victorious LGBTQ candidates. The rainbow-tinted blue wave that swept Democrats into the majority in the U.S. House also included a record number of women and people of color. The only queer-specific measure on any midterm ballot this time asked voters in the state of Massachusetts if they wanted to protect transgender people from discrimination. Ann Northrup and Andy Hum of Gay USA TV underscored the lesson hopefully learned in that campaign.
Massachusetts retained its non-discrimination law on the basis of gender identity and expression.
More than 2-1. The voters of Massachusetts.
Well, the polling had been very good, but we're always nervous about these things because of a hidden vote.
We put transgender people, including young people, front and center.
I love my kids, and I'd do anything to protect them. For me, that includes taking care of my transgender son, Ian. Just like other kids, he likes hanging out with friends. So I want him to be protected from discrimination in public places like restaurants.
That's why I'm asking you to vote yes on question 3. It lets me live my life just like everyone else.
Vote yes on 3.
And protect Massachusetts kids like me.
That's the way to do it, folks. It's not by, you know, having just advocates talk for us and all that. You have to show people what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, and we won.
Andy Hum and Ann Northrup will have more thoughts on the implications of the U.S. midterm elections a little bit later. There were far too many qualified queer candidates for us to report on here, so we'll try to sample some of the most significant races and trailblazers. Colorado's governor-elect Democrat Jared Polis got the national media spotlight. It's been 14 years since Democratic New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy belatedly outed himself and resigned under a cloud of scandal. Polis is now the first already out gay candidate to be elected governor in any state in the union.
I pledge to serve all Coloradans, no matter your party, no matter where you live, no matter your race, or no matter your gender. We are all in this together. Tonight, right here in Colorado, we proved that no barrier should stand in the way of pursuing our dreams. We proved that we're an inclusive state that values every contribution, regardless of someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. And for the LGBTQ pioneers, for equality, and the generations before me who endured so much hardship and hurt to make it possible for so many of us, myself included, to live and to love openly and proudly, and to the people right here in this room, I want to say I'm profoundly grateful for all the work we've done to overcome. Thank you.
Vermont Democrat Christine Hallquist had already made history by being the first transgender candidate chosen in the gubernatorial primary of a major political party. She was gracious in defeat after losing her uphill battle to unseat a popular Republican incumbent.
I'm going to tell you one of the more beautiful stories that I saw on the campaign. You know, on the primary night, I was up in Island Pond, and this big, burly man came running across the parking lot, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. But he ran up, and he says, oh, my God, I thought you were going to leave without me saying hello. He says, I am so proud of you, and I'm so, you know, happy with the work you're doing. I just wanted to shake your hand. So Vermonters all over, we are a welcoming and inclusive state, and I love Vermont. And we all will continue to strive to make a better Vermont, and nothing is impossible when you're on the side of justice. Thank you so much.
The election of an intersectional candidate in Kansas also got some national attention. Lesbian Democrat Charisse Davids will be one of the first two Native American women in the U.S. Congress. Davids is also an accomplished martial arts expert. She told MSNBC's Rachel Maddow what prompted her to become a first-time candidate, and one of her campaign messages brought the point home.
I think that at the core of what helped me feel empowered to do this was that I knew my community could do so much more and have a much stronger voice in Washington, D.C. than what we had with Congressman Yoder. And, you know, starting off at Johnson County Community College right here in our community and making my way to Cornell for law school, I mean, so much of the opportunity I've had in my life stemmed from the support I've had here and, you know, having a strong public education foundation and all of those things combined just led me to take the leap because I knew that we could do so much better than what we had. Making sure that people knew what we were fighting for.
This is a tough place to be a woman. I've been put down, pushed aside, knocked out. Truth is, I've had to fight my whole life because of who I am, who I love, and where I started. But I didn't let anything get in my way. Still, it's 2018, and women, Native Americans, gay people, the unemployed and underemployed, have to fight like hell just to survive. And it's clear, Trump and the Republicans in Washington don't give a damn about anyone like me or anyone that doesn't think like them. Enough. That's why I'm running for Congress.
More victorious queer candidates from the November 6th U.S. midterm elections in a moment.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. An informed community is a strong community.
Out lesbian Democrat Angie Craig won a rematch and unseated the incumbent Republican in Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District. She'll be the first openly lesbian mom in Congress, and her wife and children were featured in campaign ads. Craig's victory celebrants also toasted the woman behind the woman.
It's been about decency and civility.
That's right.
And it's about working together to try to find common ground and actually govern in this country.
That's
again.
That's right.
What a moment this is. None of it would have been possible, though, without the love and support of my family.
Yeah!
Cheryl, 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 Cheryl. Cheryl Green, thank you for encouraging me to do this again and for being with me every single step of the way.
A 36-year-old Democrat also ousted a Republican Indiana state Senate incumbent who held the seat since 2005. J.D. Ford becomes the first out LGBTQ state-level elected official. He told Indianapolis TV station WISH that he knew he was blazing a trail.
It's not lost on me about the historical significance, but as I mentioned tonight, this win truly is about giving a voice to LGBTQ plus Hoosiers. They didn't pass the hate crimes bill in the last General Assembly session, and so for me, this is what this boils down to. The voters in our district, they spoke loud tonight.
The voters of Michigan made Democrat Dana Nessel attorney general and the first queer office holder in the state. And she was yet another victorious married lesbian mom. She thanked her twin sons and smooched her significant other on election night.
I would like to thank my family. Where are you guys? My beautiful sons, Alex and Zach. And of course, more than anything, my beautiful wife for sticking with me through all of this. Thank you, Alana. I love you. And for all of you out there that can't handle the fact that I'm about to become the first openly gay person to hold statewide office.
Whereupon she kissed her wife, Alana McGuire. The first openly LGBTQ member of the U.S. Senate is Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin. She fended off the formidable challenge of a Republican opponent who was bankrolled by the far-right uber-wealthy Koch brothers to the tune of at least $10 million, according to reports. She stressed the need for reconciliation and bipartisan cooperation now that Donald Trump's presidency has a Democratic-controlled House to check and balance him.
Make no mistake, I am proud to be a Wisconsin progressive. Our democracy demands more than trying simply to beat the other side. We are better as a country than where we find ourselves today. We all know it. So let us tonight start working together to advance a common good.
Ann Northrup and Andy Hum assessed the mixed bag of midterm election results in the U.S. House and Senate on their Gay USA TV program recorded November 7th and bid a not cheerful hasta la vista to an infamous Kentucky clerk.
I have a list of things that might come up in the House.
Yeah, I think we should tell people. Because right. What did we win?
Well, we hope we've won the Equality Act finally getting passed by the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi did talk about this some in the election process.
We won
process.
A check and balance on this horrible president. That's what we won.
If we stand firm. Now, one of my concerns is that Democrats... I mean, look at Chuck Schumer.
Will fold like a cheap suit?
Well, look what Chuck Schumer did with the judges before the election. Say, that's okay. We'll pass another 15 of your judges as long as we get to go home and campaign.
The fact that we did not win back the Senate means we are condemned to getting all these horrible judges confirmed by the Senate almost automatically.
Yep.
There's almost no one to stop them now. That's horrible.
It is horrible. They can't pass everything in the Senate with a majority. They need 60 for a lot of stuff. But the Equality Act, at least symbolically, we can pass and then hold their feet to the fire in the Senate. And
I mean, there are some
president.
Republicans who support the Equality Act, a handful.
But is Mitch McConnell going to let them vote for it? Trans-military stuff may come up, and having a Democratic House may help on that. Religious freedom stuff we may be able to stop more easily with a Democratic House. There are some adoption regulations that we may be able to do better on. The definition of sex discrimination to include sexual orientation and gender identity could be helped by a Democratic House.
But most importantly, let's look at who are going to be heading the committees in the House now. Congressman Jerry Nadler, a great liberal, is going to be the head of the House Judiciary Committee. Mm-hmm. He has already announced that he is going to conduct certain investigations into the Trump administration and malfeasance. Adam Schiff is going to head the Intelligence Committee. Finally, we're going to find out what's going on there. Elijah Cummings is going to be head of Oversight and Government Reform of Maryland. Maxine Waters is head of the Financial Services Commission, and she can investigate the criminality of the Trump crime family.
Yeah, we may hear more about her checkered
Richard
career.
Richard Neal of Massachusetts is head of Ways and Means, and he has already said, I have a perfect right now to see Trump's tax returns, and I am going to. He can see anybody's tax returns in the country, so watch out.
And Really, not sorry to see Kim Davis lose the county clerkship in Kentucky.
She was spending too much time in Romania in an unsuccessful effort to ban same-sex marriage in the Constitution of Romania.
And other countries around the world.
Oh, boy. Well, that's probably...
She's the traveling show.
She lost for clerk. You're out of a job. It's sweet.
And the guy who beat her said, I will give marriage licenses to everyone. So don't you let me see you cry. Don't you let me see you cry. There will be a bright tomorrow. However dark the night. Let there be the morning light. However dark the night.
A big thanks to our friends Ann Northrup and Andy Hum. You can find them at gayusatv.org. We'll have more queer relevant elections results in still contested races and some of the other notable victories we didn't have time for in this report next time on This Way Out. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Sarah Sweeney and Michael LeBeau, produced with Brian DeShazer. Taylor Mack performed Patti Smith's The People Have the Power live on CBS's The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Peter Gallagher sang However Dark the Night from the Idolmaker motion picture soundtrack. And Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Thanks for helping to keep our 30-year streak going at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media and wherever you get your podcasts. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WMNBLP, North Adams, Massachusetts, KFAR, Knoxville, Tennessee, CFRC, Kingston, Ontario, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Max Elbaum has seen and been through a lot of political turbulence and left organizing. He joined Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, in the 1960s, and he participated in numerous campaigns to oppose U.S. militarism and defend affirmative action, and in efforts to construct a new revolutionary political party in the U.S. Currently an editor of Organizing Upgrade, Max has written for publications like The Nation, Crossroads, and War Times, and his book Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turned to Lenin, Mao, and Che, is out in a new edition with a foreword by Alicia Garza. Max Elbaum spoke in Oakland in April at a West Coast launch event for the new edition. The event was sponsored by the Center for Political Education. Later this hour, you'll hear from the co-directors of the Center, a San Francisco-based organization that acts as a resource for political groupings on the left, progressive social movements, the working class, and people of color. We begin by presenting Max Elbaum's talk on April 21st at First Congregational Church of Oakland. Max began by looking back to 1968.
By this time, people my age had either directly experienced or witnessed tremendous shock, horror, and destruction. We'd been gripped by the fear of imminent nuclear annihilation during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and when we were barely in our teens, and then we were stunned by the assassination of a president. We saw on TV or with our own eyes the dogs unleashed on civil rights workers and mobs of young whites beating up black people for the crime of sitting at a lunch counter. And then there was Vietnam, a war brought to every home, every night, on television. Not like today, when the pictures of the killing are often hidden. Just about every day, from the time I was 17 till the time I was in my early 20s, I saw somebody shot on television. Not to mention seeing the photos of the My Lai massacre and watching as a U.S. officer with a straight face said we had to burn down this village in order to save it. And, of course, people my age, if we weren't sent to Vietnam ourselves, all knew people who were in Vietnam, many of whom were going to come home with PTSD, wounds, or come home in a body bag. And there were more assassinations, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy. We lived with pain, fear, and often desperation. But there was another side. Despite all that, it was a time of incredible optimism and hope. We were going to win and create a better world. We had seen Southern governors standing at those university gates saying segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. 2 years later, Jim Crow was outlawed. After that, the black movement didn't stop. It gained momentum. Vietnam was being threatened with genocide, but the Tet Offensive in early 1968 shook the U.S. war machine to its core and made it clear that however long it took, Washington's empire-building project was going to lose the first war in its history. And it wasn't just Vietnam. As I just said, all across what we then called the Third World, freedom movements were shaking colonialism and foreign domination from Uruguay to Palestine, from South Africa to the Philippines. And when, on March 31st, 1968, Lyndon Johnson withdrew from the presidential race and announced that peace talks would begin with the Vietnamese, every single one of us who had protested believed we had taken part in overthrowing a president of the United States, not through the cruel means of assassination, but through mass political action. Revolution wasn't only in the Third World. If I can be allowed a personal story, I remember the day the woman in my SDS chapter, who had spent 1968 in France, came back and reported on her experience in the French May. 10 million workers on strike and students on the night of the barricades came this close to toppling the government in the heart of industrialized Western Europe. And I can still feel my heart race when she recounted the slogan they chanted as they marched through the streets where the Paris Commune first put a worker seizure of power on the world's agenda in 1871. We shall fight. We shall win. Paris, London, Rome, Berlin. Is it any wonder that so many of us became revolutionaries in the wake of experiences like those? We had a vision. We were part of an unstoppable human surge toward a better world. It was anchored in the rising of what Frantz Fanon called the wretched of the earth, but it embraced and welcomed everyone who had a conscience. It had a moral as well as a political dimension. Of course, we knew we had to fight those who were described so eloquently in Curtis Mayfield's anthem, People Get Ready, the hopeless sinners who would hurt all mankind just to save their own. But it wasn't viewed as a struggle of good people versus evil people. It was a fight against unjust systems of oppression. Of course, those systems hit hardest on the most marginalized, but they affected everyone. Our aim was to build a better world for all and usher in a new and brighter stage of world history. And every single person who joined the fight had a contribution to make. Now, most of tonight, it's going to be devoted to talk about how complicated it is to make that vision in real practice. How often we strayed from it, how many mistakes my generation made, even as we did our best and made some useful contributions. But I want to say at the outset, that vision remains a lodestar worth fighting for. And I want to add this. Amid today's call-out culture and internet flame wars, which have caused so much pain to those struggling to make a difference, my generation on the left engaged in many stupid sectarian fights with one another. Our framework, though, was that everyone who joined the movement had a contribution to make. For sure, white male privilege was frequently exercised, and it was an ongoing battle to challenge racist, sexist, and homophobic dynamics. But despite many mistakes, we tried to stay in the realm of politics and avoid taking down and disrespecting individuals. I think that approach is needed today more than ever. Furthermore, standing shoulder to shoulder for positive change doesn't require, and in fact it does not benefit by, forcing agreement with any single monolithic ideology. Different ones of us may draw philosophical inspiration from different sources. The noblest sentiments from Jesus Christ or the prophet Muhammad, the Native American elders or the Hebrew prophets, Martin Luther King or Sojourner Truth, Karl Marx, Che Guevara, the Combahee River Collective. In 1968, people across the spectrum like that came together in the last worldwide upsurge for justice. We need to be at least as broad-minded as we prepare for the next surge toward freedom. Back in 1968, especially after Martin Luther King's assassination, a whole layer of 1960s activists decided that the socioeconomic system in the United States could not be reformed, and that to bring about peace, racial equality, and justice, a social revolution was necessary. And we looked around for a theory, a strategy, forms of organization that could bring such a revolution about. Inevitably, the directions we went were shaped by the historical moment, and in particular, by the contours of the radical left across the globe at that time. In my book, I tried to capture the result this way. Inspired by the dynamic liberation movements that threatened to besiege Washington with two, three, many Vietnams, many decided that a third world-oriented version of Marxism was the key to building a powerful left. In tune with the central axes of 1960s protests, Third World Marxism put opposition to racism and military interventionism front and center. It riveted attention on the intersection of economic exploitation and racial oppression, pointing young activists toward the most disadvantaged sectors of the working class. It linked aspiring U.S. revolutionaries to the parties and leaders who were proving that the power of the people was greater than the man's technology. The Vietnamese and Chinese Communist parties, Amilcar Cabral and the Marxist-led liberation movements in Africa, Che, Fidel, and the Cuban Revolution. Third World Marxism promised a break with Eurocentric models of social change and pointed a way toward building a multiracial movement out of a badly segregated U.S. left. It seemed to be the best framework to take the radical themes struck by Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Cesar Chavez, the U.S. figures that most inspired 60s youth, and transforming them into a comprehensive revolutionary ideology. Within the Third World Marxist ranks, a determined contingent set out to build tight-knit cadre organizations. We believed that there would be a short-lived lull and that it was urgent to prepare a united and militant vanguard so that the revolutionary potential that was glimpsed in the 1960s could be pushed further the next time around. And to guide that kind of process, not just Marxism, but Leninism was deemed as indispensable. Partly that was because the parties we looked to for inspiration based themselves on Marxism-Leninism, and partly it was also due to our own experience with COINTELPRO, state repression, and violence against the social movements. This current on the left, the new communist component of the third world Marxist milieu, was not the only one that attracted 1960s radicals. Every single section of the left, social democracy, traditional communism, anarchism, revolutionary nationalism, revolutionary feminism, every single section of the left grew. But this current attracted more than any other single trend, and especially the largest number coming out of the freedom movements in communities of color. Now, the bulk of chapters in Revolution in the Air trace the history of this current, from its explosive rise in the 1960s and early 70s, through a decade of plus of hard work in the 70s and under Ronald Reagan, to its demise as a coherent force at the end of the 1980s. It details the theoretical frameworks and strategies adopted by the different groups, the different organization-building efforts, the political disputes that kept us from uniting as a single organization or party. It recounts the movement's work in unions, in international solidarity, anti-racist campaigns, in the women's and LGBTQ movements. An entire chapter is devoted to the movement's political culture and the ways our approaches were and were not democratic. Notice taken of the seven new communist activists who were murdered in the course of their work and the campaigns for justice which followed. Five members of the Communist Workers' Party, shot down in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1979 by Klan and Nazi members with the complicity of the Greensboro Police Department. And my dear comrades and friends, Selmy Domingo and Jean Viernes, Filipino labor activists and members of the Line of March who were assassinated in their union hall June 1st, 1981, on the orders of the Marcos regime.
That's the voice of Max Elbaum, who was a leader of one of the main new communist movement organizations. He's the author of Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turned to Lenin, Mao, and Che. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's return now to more of the talk that Max Elbaum gave earlier this year in Oakland.
In these remarks, I want to focus on a few general themes where some of our experience may be useful for today's struggles. First, I want to target what I think was our most fundamental error. We misassessed the historical moment we were in, the balance of forces we faced, and the resilience of the U.S. political system. That error led us to adopt strategies, tactics, and organizational forms that isolated us from the very constituencies we were so determined to root ourselves in. We had become radical at a time of intense, rapid change, and when masses of people in the United States were in an explosive mood. So we overgeneralized from our experience. We didn't think it would continue in a straight line, but pretty close. We expected that after a relatively brief ebb, there would be another upsurge, and inevitably it would be further to the left. We also thought that because the masses had rejected one or two presidents, that they were millions and millions of people who were ready to reject the political system, the electoral system altogether. So we prepared for offensive battles. We regarded electoral involvement as at best a waste of time. And we built the kinds of organizations fitted for a whole different kind of historical period or society. 70s went a different way. Instead of a new upsurge, the ruling class regrouped, retrenched, skillfully cultivated a racist, sexist, national chauvinist, and homophobic backlash against movements here and abroad. And once the Vietnam was over and equality was proclaimed in law, even if not in practice, The more progressive masses and their millions understandably tried to resist using the most ready-to-hand tools available, that is, fighting on electoral and policy terrain. We forgot Lenin's admonition that what may be obsolete for revolutionaries is not obsolete for the masses. Exhorting people to be more radical has minimal effect. Only going through the experience of trying to take what the system offers as far as it can go and then being stymied will millions decide to take a harder and more risky path. So we ended up with Ronald Reagan, and by the time we realized what had occurred and threw ourselves into the Rainbow Coalition and the other mass struggles of the 1980s, we had suffered too many losses to regain political momentum. So the point being, we need some hard-headed realism to go along with our revolutionary passion. We need to keep in mind that forces far more powerful than ourselves are setting the agenda. I'm going to read another short passage from my book about that. If, when, and how masses swing into motion is generally not something under radicals' control, but it is the activity and consciousness of popular constituencies that must shape radical efforts. Many of us once thought that becoming a revolutionary meant seeing the world through the filter of passages from Lenin. But in our zeal to adopt a revolutionary identity, we overlooked one of the things Lenin wrote that is actually has a universal meaning, something not particularly Leninist at all, but common to effective radical leaders of all persuasions. Quote, politics begin where millions of men and women are, where there are not thousands, but millions. Radicals must strain every nerve to gain and keep a connection to those millions. We need a connection in life, sustained over time through durable organizations and institutions, not merely in theory or self-conception, or during brief moments of high-tide protest. This places a premium on resisting all sectarianism and flexibly adapting to new and often unexpected conditions. Second point. In striving for theoretical clarity, we embraced a dogmatic mindset, and in our search for effective strategy, we too often adopted a kind of tunnel vision. It's one thing to embrace and learn from the theoretical insights of past revolutionaries. It's quite another, and too much like the quick fix thinking that so dominates U.S. culture, to think we're going to find some all but omniscient package under the brand of Marxism-Leninism. As our movement ebbed, we sought salvation in ideological purification and a quest for orthodoxy, which was the very opposite of the expansive thinking that had characterized our early years. In terms of strategy, it absolutely makes sense to identify key sectors of a population that can serve as an anchor for radical politics. But in doing so, there's a danger of falling into too narrow a focus. Our tendencies in this direction were costly. We too often gave short shrift to the women's and LGBTQ movements, and we were complacent or too slow in battling homophobia. And we all but totally missed the deepening environmental crisis and the threat of climate change. These shortcomings were factors in producing the kind of single-issue fights and the so-called silo phenomenon that is so much bemoaned today. And sensitivity to this problem is especially urgent because today we have both the possibility and the imperative to break out of silos and coalesce our movements into a unified force. Third, looking at the Black Freedom Movement as a reference point and anchor and driving force of all the progressive fights in the particular history of the United States was a strength of those of us who turned to Third World Marxism. There's been a great explosion of new theoretical and historical work illuminating the condition of African Americans, the dynamics of anti-Black racism, the centrality of slavery to the development not only of U.S. capitalism, but of global capitalism. There's a welcome explosion of new and innovative forms of organization and communication as a new generation of activists move center stage. But the overarching point is that a strategy to change the United States has to be rooted in the particular history of the United States. And a key particularity of U.S. history is the way black labor has built the country, and black movements have most often been the driving force, not just advancing the condition of African Americans, but of every progressive movement and opening up democratic space in general. It was true in the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, which saw the most progressive state governments ever to exist in the United States of America. It was true in the 1950s and 60s when the black-led civil rights movement broke the back of McCarthyism and opened up the space for all the new social movements of the 1960s. In what's called Second Reconstruction. And it's why the framework utilized by Reverend William Barber and others who are launching the new Poor People's Campaign, the call for a third Reconstruction, has such resonance and potential today. Rooted in the black prophetic tradition, its vision is to bind together all the different fights into a unified whole for the revolution of values that Martin Luther King said was necessary back in 1967. Last point. We can't help but take note that we live in the era of Donald Trump. A white nationalist surge drove him to the presidency, and unfortunately, similar regimes based in racist and xenophobic authoritarianism are afflicting many other countries across the globe. A bit over a year ago, at the People Get Ready conference sponsored by the Center for Political Education right after the election, my longtime friend and comrade Linda Burnham made this point in her keynote speech. We cannot let the harsh realities of the moment stifle our revolutionary imagination. At the same time, we cannot let our revolutionary imagination blind us to the harsh realities of the moment. The challenge we face today is that the balance between those two is not as favorable as it was in 1968. At that time, the initiative was with those full of revolutionary imagination. Today, the initiative is with those who are inflicting harsh realities on people here and all over the world. They're on the march. They're putting in place mechanisms to stay in power and enrich themselves, whether it be voter suppression, mass incarceration, attacks on the media and civil liberties, and the danger of outright war. We need to be sober-minded about this. The trick is not to be in denial about the challenge, but to identify and nurture the shoots of resistance, which are the building blocks of the future and the sources of hope. Today, there is a massive anti-Trump front taking shape in this country. Its core lies in communities of color and among young people. But it stretches all the way from corporate power brokers in the Democratic Party through Bernie Sanders and other progressives all the way to many Marxist revolutionaries. So it includes people, players, who don't share the values of those of us in this room. But that's always the case in truly massive movements. We need to remember that no radical project has ever succeeded when it tried to fight every single one of its enemies at once. Divisions in a ruling elite have been a key factor in every successful movement, not just for revolution, but for radical reform in the history of the United States and the history of other countries in the world. Within this huge, complicated coalition against the far right, there's a growing and dynamic progressive sector, showing itself in the women's marches, in the electoral insurgencies, in defense of immigrants, demanding an end to police killings, in the movement for single-payer health care, in the recent wave of teacher strikes, and not least, in the day-in and day-out heroic efforts of all those service providers aiding the homeless, the vulnerable, and the afflicted. If that layer can coalesce, and if it can make efforts to end militarism and war as strong as its campaigns on other issues, this is a grave weakness of the progressive coalition right now of integrating movements against demands against aggression and militarism and war into all the other tapestry of progressive movements. If we can do that, an agenda of peace, jobs, justice, and saving the planet can attain a measure of power. Last, within that upsurge, there are more and more people, especially young people, who, just like the generation of 1968, are embracing an inclusive, humanistic, and revolutionary vision. Those of us from my generation, our task is to share our stories, pass the torch, do what we can to pitch in as the new generation carries on the fight until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
You are listening to Max Elbaum speaking at an event marking the release of the new edition of his book, Revolution in the Air, published by Verso. Here's something Max said at the audience Q&A portion of the event.
The history of U.S. politics of upsurges has been that at any given moment, there has been a coalition to fight the main battle against slavery, against despotism in the 30s, and against Jim Crow and Vietnam in the 60s. And in each of those cases, a coalition came together that included elements of the ruling class and the grassroots progressive forces. And when that kind of coalition was necessary to defeat slavery, to win labor rights, and to defeat Jim Crow, you needed that coalition. But then when that immediate thing was won, the coalition broke up. And in each of those previous cases, the progressive wing of that coalition was marginalized. Our task today and the opportunity we have is that now there's that same kind of coalition against the racist, authoritarian right embodied in the Trump administration. We are gaining more initiative within that front. The official Democrats are all confused. I mean, they have all their backward stuff, but the progressives have the momentum. If we can defeat the authoritarian right, which is the main obstacle to anything happening, not to mention the survival of the planet, given climate change denialism, we have the opportunity to make that progressive pole not be marginalized, but to carry more strength into whatever comes next. Possibly not be the dominant force, but be a power that cannot be dislodged in mass politics in the U.S.
Max Elbaum, veteran campaigner, organizer, agitator, writer, and editor. He spoke in Oakland on April 21st at an event sponsored by the Center for Political Education. The event also featured Alicia Garza, who wrote the foreword to the new edition of Max's book, Revolution in the Air. I want to thank Lisa Detmer for recording and providing the audio, which was edited by yours truly. We'll take a short break and then speak with the co-directors of the Center for Political Education. Their names are Rachel Herzing and Isaac Ontiveros. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What Max Elbaum does in the way of gleaning insights from past struggles has a parallel in the efforts of the Center for Political Education. CPE, which is based in San Francisco, organizes and hosts classes, public events, and other gatherings devoted to informing and inspiring political organizations on the left, progressive social movements, the working class, and people of color. The Center for Political Education is co-directed by Rachel Herzing and Isaac Ontiveros. Rachel has worked in the anti-prison industrial complex movement and the anti-violence movement. She's also worked in youth development. Isaac has experience in media and communications, publishing, and anti-violence, labor, and anti-prison industrial complex organizing and advocacy. When Isaac and Rachel joined me in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I began by asking how important they believed theory is to effective organizing and mobilizing on the left.
I think the Center for Political Education thinks that it's essential. I think we have a commitment to helping people understand the theoretical foundations of their fights and use them, because we feel that when people have a good understanding of the, you know, material conditions that they're fighting in, they have a good sense of kind of the balance of forces, and they have an overarching theory that drives how they develop strategy, that they'll be able to fight more effectively and win more frequently.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think part of our approach is also to think about the theory making that social movements and, you know, thinkers and doers from all over the world have done in the past generations. And a piece that we return to a lot in our work is Amilcar Cabral's Weapon of Theory. And we've done a lot of thinking in the past couple of years about how theory is a weapon, and kind of following on his ideas about theory being a way in which people who have been denied control of their material conditions or their understanding of history or the present or the future, been, you know, aggressively and violently denied that, using an explanation of how the world works or how social change works or how our understanding in a self-conscious way, our place in it, then allows us to understand history and the present and the future different. And I think that's also essential if our task is to change the world.
Well, the two of you and the Center for Political Education interact with, engage a lot of grassroots organizers and activists in the workshops and the trainings that you do. What is your sense of the degree to which organizers and activists today engage with theory, consider it important, deem it the kind of thing that is worth spending time on in terms of, as you said, understanding the situation perhaps before acting, before taking action?
When we began our tenure as co-directors of the center, we spent a couple months talking to dozens of organizations and movement leaders around the Bay Area to ask kind of those questions. What, if any, kind of political education were organizations involved in? How did that impact their work? How did that drive the decisions that they were making about campaigns, et cetera? And my sense is that we found two things. We found, on the one hand, that there was a fairly high value on it, that people said, oh, yeah, we definitely need to understand kind of the theoretical orientations of our work. Our people generally need more support in that. And at the same time, that organizations were not prioritizing doing that work, so that we would hear frequently, we know that it's really important. We just can't fit that in. We're so busy with our work. We're so busy with our campaign, or we're so busy with our project that we can't fit that in. And so I think my sense is that there is a high value on it, but that high value doesn't always turn all the way over into kind of a prioritization of that theoretical advancement organizationally.
I think in this moment, there's also not connected to what you were saying, Rachel, is also this value on rebuilding radical movements and rebuilding the left. And I think one of the things that people are experiencing and also struggling to articulate is the way in which the kind of counter-revolutions of the last couple of generations have really put movements for social change, radical movements, left movements, have, you know, kind of fractured them, made the left relatively small, and also its capacity to be these kind of rigorous incubators for thinking, for theoretical practice, for development of ideas, and we're also attacked. And I think our communities are, or we see these organizations that we work with living in the kind of in the rubble, in the political rubble of that counter-revolution. And so this problem that Rachel pointed out of having the value, but kind of having the space or the tools be less, I don't know, available or sharp. I think that's the intersection that we're trying to work at.
Now, what you and your colleagues convey in terms of theory to people who take advantage of you as a resource will depend on what priority you assign to certain ideas. And I think that will be informed by your own or the center's political grounding, right? The kinds of ideas that animate the two of you and the people who are part of the center. So can you share with us some of that, what ideas you've personally come to find very fruitful and want to further the legacy of?
So I think that, you know, it's pretty explicit in our work that we find a Marxist methodology useful to understanding social, political, and economic conditions and understanding the ways in which people take up the change work that they're involved in. The articulations of Marxist thinking and practice that emanate or were developed in the third world are particularly important to our work, given the ways in which those struggles in the past generations and up to the current moment have used and developed and added to and stretched and applied a materialist conception of history, a dialectical method, a radical critique of political economy. The way that they have mobilized those ideas through their struggles in their particular conditions offers, if we understand ourselves to have an internationalist point of view or an international understanding of making change and struggling for freedom or even our ideas of freedom, then there's a very unique and powerful contribution that those movements have offered all people.
And, you know, to Isaac's point, I would agree that, you know, the kind of articulation of historical materialist method, for instance, coming out of the third world has really informed how we do our work at the center and has helped, I think, articulate the raced and gendered nature of what we're up against in really smart and useful ways that don't come, you know, from other traditions the same way. And I think also a commitment to anti-imperialism that comes out of, you know, that tradition is really close to the heart of the center as well.
Rachel Herzing and Isaac Ontiveros are co-directors of the Center for Political Education, which is based in San Francisco. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Your focus, and your focus is broad, but Isaac, you mentioned Marx, and you folks have put on workshops, so Marxism 101 workshops, which I think are six-part discussions of Marxist theory and practice. You know, some people of color, some radicals of color, who see Marxism as primarily focused on class instead of race, they, many of them, shy away from Marx and his ideas in favor of other thinkers. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, for when we do the Marxism 101 class, we like to take that head on. We take it head on, and I think what we do is we draw on the politics that we were describing earlier. We understand that, I would say that we would share the fact that so much of the theoretical development of Marxism and so much of it having imminent relevance for the understanding of how racism works or gendered oppression works was coming from radical thinkers who were in dialogue with Marxist theory and practice who were not European white men, right? Who were involved in the struggles of the third world, in the diasporas of third world people in this country or wherever else. And that is as rich a legacy of Marxist theory and practice as is theoretical development coming from Western Europe. One of the most special parts of the class that we've done in the past couple of years is to share with people, and it's been wonderful, particularly for people who are less familiar or completely unfamiliar with the work and the thinking of Claudia Jones. And here is this communist thinker and doer and revolutionary living in the United States as a migrant. And in the 30s and 40s, she's developing these ideas that have come to be common sense on the left of different types of traditions, the sense of intersectionality, the understanding of the ways in which racialized and gendered oppression intersect with the exploitation of labor, and how developing one helps us fight better on the other front.
And where was Claudia Jones from?
Trinidad.
Mm-hmm. I see that one aim of the an upcoming conference that you're convening this Saturday in Berkeley, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. It's called People Get Ready 2, is aimed at assessing the post-midterm terrain. And I can't resist the temptation to ask you both just, you know, how you would evaluate what just happened through the lens of prospects for the left, prospects for the radical left, where a left project might be able to go given what happened in the midterms.
I am historically not a super fan of electoral politics. And I also know in this period, paying attention to where power lies and how it is mobilized, where I live and globally, is really, really crucial. And the rise of the authoritarian right in the United States and globally is something we all have to take, I think, attention toward. And the articulation of those politics through traditional electoral bodies, you know, so for in our case, Trump and the Trump regime in the United States and holding the presidency, but also the kind of mechanisms and scaffolding and architecture that allow him to be in office, all the way from, you know, billionaire benefactors through to legislators in the Congress and in the Senate. And I think this was not a negative referendum on Trump. I think it might be optimistic. Anybody who thinks that, you know, Trump got any kind of comeuppance, I think, might be being overly optimistic. And at the same time, I think we did see a kind of a surge in all kinds of activity that make me more optimistic for what could be built. So that we saw, for instance, record turnout for people voting, period. And that, you know, the kind of disaffection that has plagued U.S. voters for decades has, you know, been motivated by, you know, deep political polarization in the country, but activated nonetheless. That we saw record numbers of women, gender nonconforming people running for office and being elected. That we saw large-scale grassroots mobilizations in favor of candidates and pieces of legislation that take up the challenges of the left in terms of rebuilding left formation, rebuilding a base of left support, but also on some of the kind of issues that radicals and progressives care about around health care, around housing, around debt, and around living wages. So I think all of those have some optimistic potential to them. The question is, you know, what will happen? The, you know, authoritarian right does not control the executive branch and both houses of the legislature. So there is a little bit of a bulwark there against kind of their pushing ahead an agenda that is, you know, death dealing to many of us. And at the same time, you know, I think we should have a bit of caution about, you know, what the Democratic Party stands for as a whole, what the various forces inside of it are, who can be pushed in what ways, and what it will take to push them.
Tell me more about this conference. Again, it's called People Get Ready 2, as in the number 2. It'll take place this Saturday, November 17th, at UC Berkeley from noon to 6. in Dwinnell Hall on the Berkeley campus. What can people expect? What kinds of sessions and keynotes have you arranged? And again, I'm speaking with Isaac Ontiveros and Rachel Herzing of the Center for Political Education, which is putting on this conference.
Well, the two part of it is that it is a second version, second installment of a conference that we held last year called People Get Ready that was held the weekend before the Trump's inauguration. And similarly, the goal there was to take stock of the political terrain and to think together about the fights ahead and what we need to do to, you know, build a more powerful, impactful left. So this conference will be similar. We will use the midterm elections as a backdrop to have those conversations. And broadly speaking, the day is split into two halves. In the first half, our work is really to think about the terrain, analyze that, and think about, in more visionary terms, what are we dealing with and what's ahead. The second half of the day is to think more strategically and tactically about how to move toward those visions.
Mm-hmm. We'll be having sessions that will gather organizers and thinkers together to talk about war, to talk about resistance to war, the movements to resist militarism at home and abroad. We'll be having sessions that will deal with what working people and people in worker-based organizations and unions or worker centers are confronting. What does things like the composition of the Supreme Court mean to their struggles to organize? But also, what does the fact that even amidst this viciously anti-labor climate that you could have these the teachers' strikes that we saw earlier this year or the hotel worker strike that's still ongoing now in some places, how is that part of our political terrain? Not just what's the next calamity to add to our checklist. And then, of course, we'll be talking about what does the elections mean. We're hoping that when we have the conversations about the elections mean and to talk about our previous conversation, that it's not just that we understand it in relationship to a balance of forces, that we understand that it's not just what's this or that personality who won or what's this or that, seats, these seats and that seats or things like this. But what does this mean for the capacity for radical organizing to extend itself? And as we get into that half of the day, then we'll have sessions on, as Rachel said, on strategy, and we'll talk about some of the work that is ongoing before the midterm and will be ongoing after, but that has to do with displacement, right? And the organizing amongst communities who don't have an option to vote, for example. And we'll also have sessions on that will take on the question of right-wing authoritarianism and fascism, as well as questions of what can a left look like right now and what are our methods and strategies for strengthening ourselves, but also what are the theories and visions of a better world that motivate us or that need to be tended to as well.
Who will some of the speakers be that are going to present at the conference?
We're very enthusiastic to have Maria Poblet open the second half of our day as a keynote speaker. The center will be opening the first half of the day to offer some remarks. We're also...
Maria Poblet is with Left Roots?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We also have, KPFA's own Walter Turner will be joining us. We're enthusiastic about that as well. We have people coming from worker backgrounds, as Isaac said, so... There'll be people, I think, representing Unite Here and the recent hotel worker strike. Who else do you have on that list, Ivan?
We have folks coming out of the migrant justice movement. So we'll have folks from organizations like the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. We'll have folks from the Haiti Action Committee to talk about what's happening in Haiti, particularly around building a radical left movement there. Where I'm excited to have some cultural workers involved. So we'll have Bay Area poet Dante Clark do a performance. And we understand that not just as a kind of fresh air before the next session start, but as a part of our thinking and analysis and the work that we do.
And all of that will be part of the People Get Ready To conference. Again, it takes place this Saturday, November 17th at UC Berkeley at Dwinnell Hall from noon to 6. For more information, you can go to the link we've provided on againstthegrain.org, where we've also put a link to the Center for Political Education, which is a San Francisco-based resource for political organizations on the left, progressive social movements, the working class, and people of color. And Isaac Ontiveros and Rachel Herzing, my guests in studio, are co-directors of the center. Thank you both for putting on this conference again, and thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us, CF.
Yeah, thank you for having us, and thanks for the work that you do.
And the center's website is politicaleducation.org. They are asking people to pre-register for the November 17th conference. You can do that by going to their website. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.